Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here, as always, to talk about stuff this week on the show. Another sort of grab bag week.
Yeah.
We have not had, like, a centralized topic in a couple weeks.
I feel like it's something where there's been a lot of things like Destiny Rise of Iron or Virginia that are games that we both have played and want to talk about, but they're not, like, huge. It's not Metal Gear Solid 5. It's not The Witcher 3. It's not Doom. It's not Uncharted 4.
Right, so we're just kind of pushing along and talking about all this stuff. I think we've been keeping our heads above water with the amount of games coming out, and I'm kind of proud of that.
And I've been enjoying this sort of, like, playing these sort of smaller games that, like, you know, I don't have to put 50 hours into Rise of Iron, or obviously, you would be insane if you put 50 hours into Virginia. That would be...
You'd be playing the game 25 times.
Yeah, exactly. or Hitman Episode 5 also came out this week, and so, like, it's been kind of fun just dipping in and trying all these different games.
Yeah, so Sean just kind of hinted at it. We're going to be talking about Hitman Episode 5. Last week, I gave a spoiler-free review of Virginia. This is a new indie game that you can get on PC, Mac, Xbox One, PS4. We played it on PS4. Highly recommended.
Yes.
And we are going to talk about the craziness of this game.
Yeah, my spoiler-free impressions are basically the same that you gave last week, Jonathan, that it's something that I also really want to play it again to, like, sort of see how the narrative ultimately falls, because there's some, like, it uses a lot of sort of very David Lynchian kind of visual symbolism stuff that I think needs a second playthrough to sort of know, okay, where do these symbols come in early, and knowing what I know about how they develop over the course of the game, how does that change my reading? Because my first playthrough, at the very end, there was some stuff that I felt like... I kind of felt like the same way about Inside or something, where it's like, there's something really interesting about this narrative, but I'm not sure if it has, like, the full impact it could. But at the same time, the way it uses this sort of very cinematic way of telling a story that's not just cutscenes, but is using, like, actual jump cuts and sort of filmic language mixed in with this sort of first-person exploration, gone-home kind of thing... That's a really awesome experiment, you know, that there's only one other game I know of called 30 Flights of Loving, which came out a couple years ago. That's another indie game on the PC that's much smaller, that also had a similar jump cut thing. But this is, like, something I want to see more games have, that kind of experimental style. And I think it's, for $10 or, like, $9 if you have PS Plus, it is well worth that price and checking out.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't know if the story fully holds together for me, but I think this is, as a, you know, piece of video game narrative experimentation, it's outstanding, and I think it's going to be very influential.
Yeah, it's something where, like, my main takeaway when I put the game down was mostly, like, I want more stuff like this. Like, I want other things that are in this style that, like, not necessarily that have the David Lynchian thing all the time, but just that way of trying to tell a story in video games. I think that's super awesome, and I want to see more games try that out with different kinds of stories and stuff.
Absolutely. So we'll talk about that. I'm going to talk about Forza Horizon 3. Spoiler-free awesome. Take on that. Not that you can spoil a racing game.
Yeah. You race!
Yes. One of the best games of the year. Unambiguously.
Cool.
Just pretty much a perfect game. Like, I'm going to give it to you right now. I have one complaint with Forza Horizon 3.
Okay.
And it's that sometimes I have difficulty visually distinguishing trees I can run over and trees that will stop my car.
It is the problem that will plague, off-road racing games till the end of time.
Yes.
Is that every time we increase our technology, it's always, like, the bar moves of, like... Or it's the same thing with, like, Grand Theft Auto or something, where it's like, what stuff can I run into with my car and just plow through? And what stuff just, like, stops me like a concrete block, even though it's a tree?
Yeah. But no, I am serious in that's pretty much my only complaint, and that is such a minor complaint.
Right.
This is... I've been thinking about this. It is probably the best exclusive on the Xbox One. It is just an outstanding game. And not just as a racing game. It's so far above and beyond what it as a genre needs to be doing. So we will talk about that. I have so much to say about that game. It is brilliant.
Awesome.
And we got some other little minor stuff. Next week's going to be an exciting show, because we're going to have a focus topic for the first time in a while, which is we're going to do a Godzilla retrospective.
Fuck yeah.
Just saying that now because we're excited, because next week, Sean, is the last weekend before Godzilla Resurgence, or Shin Godzilla, as it's called, is coming to theaters.
Yes, and we both have our tickets to go see it. I am tremendously excited. I am still plugging away on my stupid fucking list that is way too long at this point, but...
We'll publish it in parts. It'll be great.
Yeah, well, I'll have to look at it and figure out how to split it up. But yeah, so that's something I'm still doing. I have wanted to do a big Godzilla retrospective on this podcast for a while, and it was like kind of unfortunate that when that the 2014 movie came out, it was at a time when we were busy with other stuff, so we couldn't spend time like doing a big Godzilla episode. So
that'll be next week.
Yes.
But anyway, let's start this week with some random stuff. So last week, Sean, you talked about playing Shenmue.
Yes, I played all of Shenmue.
Yes. So I guess
that's a game.
Yes, it is a game. So I guess like unconsciously or subconsciously, I decided I need to go play like an old game so I can talk about it on the podcast.
Okay, yeah.
I don't know. So I have been just playing some random Mario games.
Sure.
Y'all know how much I love Mario. It's probably my favorite video game series.
Sure.
You know, because I think it's just an easy one for me to say that on, because like, yeah, my two favorite games ever are Persona 3 and 4, but I don't know if I can say like Persona as a series is my favorite series when it, for me, consists mainly of two games.
Right, yeah.
And a bunch of spin-offs, which are fun, but you know, they're not.
Yeah, no, I get what you mean. Yeah. Like, it's the Persona team games.
Right, yeah. So, you know, I love Mario, but as many Mario games as I've played, as much as I love Mario, there are holes in my Mario, like, education. There are Mario games I have not played.
Okay.
So one of those was Super Mario Land on the Game Boy.
Right, yes.
Which has become a fairly obscure Mario game, even though it was a huge hit when it came out.
Yeah, I feel like you never really hear people talk about that one, even though I played a bit of that back in the day.
Yeah, and it was a launch title on the Game Boy. It was that and Tetris. You could get day one. I was actually looking this up. It was that, Tetris, and then like games that were just literally called Soccer, Baseball, Basketball.
Like it was the Atari 2600 or something. It's like, let's just put in golf.
Yeah. But no, I mean, so Super Mario Land has kind of faded into obscurity, while I think some of the sequels, like Mario Land 2, which is 6 gold coins, that's a classic. I think people talk about that one.
Sure, yeah.
And then the third one was Wario Land, which obviously started its own thing, and I think Wario Land is one of the greatest games ever made.
Yeah. I think it's Wario Land 4 on the Game Boy Advance is the one I played a bunch of that.
Phenomenal game. They're all good. Yeah. But, so I'd never really played Super Mario Land, and part of why is that, again, Game Boy launch title, so it's very technically primitive. Like, the graphics, even for the Game Boy, are very limited.
Yeah.
And it also is kind of weird because it doesn't have any sort of save feature, which most Game Boy games would go on to have, obviously, but this was 1989. I think some people forget how old the Game Boy is. Mm-hmm. Like, because I think, you know, 1989, obviously, we're still in NES territory. The Super NES hasn't even come out. The Game Boy was Nintendo's second console. So it's just crazy things like that.
I mean, the Game Boy is where Metroid 2 originally came out.
Yes,
you know?
Stuff like that. So, just kind of strange. But, you know, I had Mario Land on my 3DS because you can get Virtual Console, you know, Game Boy games there. So I was like, you know what? This game is super short. It's only 12 levels long. I've never played it. And I was just kind of goofing around with it. I'm like, I just need to take the hour or two it would take to play this and play this game. That's a great game.
Cool. Yeah.
Just like Super Mario Land, I feel like, again, I just want to bang the drum for it because I think it's a bit of a forgotten Mario title. It's very strange. It's not set in the Mushroom Kingdom. It's technically set in this land called Sarasa Land or something. It's a very weird name, but it's got like Egyptian overtones at times. You go to this land that's very clearly Chinese influenced.
Right.
The Koopas, when you stomp on them, their shells become bombs and explode. The Goombas
obviously, you know, that's how those like Egyptian Koopas, you know, it's just sort of a slightly different species.
It really, like, I was thinking about this, it's like Mario through the looking glass. It's like you have Mario, and then you go through the looking glass, like in that Mickey Mouse short, and it's like, it's all the stuff you know, but just slightly different, and it's really disorienting.
Uh-huh.
But I love that about it. And at its core, I mean, it is, I think, the most similar to, like, original Super Mario Bros. 1985, other than, like, Japanese Mario 2, which is just the same game with more levels, right? This is the only one that... Because this is one of the, I think, the things I love about Mario is that's not a series that generally repeats itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, American Mario 2 is totally different from Mario 1. Mario 3 is totally different. Mario World is totally different. Mario 64, like, it's just not a series that generally does repetition.
Yeah.
So Mario Land, it is kind of nice. It's like, this is kind of like a proper sequel in some ways to, like, Mario 85, but really weird and on a handheld.
Yeah.
So you have to get over some of the graphical stuff and that it does look weird, and there's things like they miniaturized everything, so everything's kind of very small and compact. I think that actually works once you get into it with kind of the Game Boy view of things.
Yeah.
But it's a really good platformer. It's got phenomenal music, for one. Like, if you've never heard the Mario Land soundtrack, it's fantastic. It's totally different than any other Mario soundtrack, and it's great. And I think, like, Like, when you turn Invincible, there's a weird thing. Like, it plays some classical piece, and I forget what it is, but it's not the traditional Mario Invincibility music. Yeah,
that would be way better. Yeah, it's like, yeah, Mario gets the star and becomes immortal and takes over the Mushroom Kingdom as their, like, demon emperor.
That's what Bowser's searching for. We just don't know it. So, but then, like, there's some of the stuff they, like, go into, like, on an imagination level in Mario Land is really fun. Like, there's this series of levels, I think it's World 3, where you have these big pits with spikes that you have to get across. And you'll get to that, and you're like, what the fuck am I supposed to do? Giant pit of spikes, I can't run across that. And then these boulders start falling from the sky, and you have to jump on the boulders and either stay on them or jump from boulder to boulder as they're moving over the pit of spikes. Like, for a 1989 Game Boy game, that's incredibly kind of ambitious and interesting. Mm-hmm. And again, you have to kind of get into it and use your imagination a little bit, because it's very sparse graphics, but it feels really kind of epic. And, like, I want to see that in, like, a modern 3D Mario game, where I have to, like, jump across a pit of, like, lava, and there's, like, boulders I have to, like, jump from one to the other. They do a little bit of that kind of stuff in Mario Galaxy, I guess. But it's just, it was kind of fun. So, I enjoyed playing that game.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, I think you can definitely see the direct connection from Super Mario Land to Shenmue. So it makes a lot of sense why you would play that in response to me playing Shenmue.
No. This is kind of a prologue to the main game I've been playing.
Oh, okay.
Which is that was one Mario game I did. That took me like an afternoon. That was nothing. But then, like, there are some other little Mario games that, like, I have never played through all of Mario Land 2, so I'm going to do that again at some point. But those are sort of smaller titles, right?
Yeah.
There is one big Mario game I have never played, and it's going to shock people when I say I've never played this game, like, full.
Okay.
It's Super Mario World.
If there's, like, one 2D Mario game people should play, it's Super Mario World.
Well, and it's funny because I feel like that is, in the entire, like, realm of gaming history, that is my biggest hole in, like, my knowledge of gaming history, is that obviously I know of Mario World. Yeah. I have played it. I've just never sat down and played the whole thing.
You know, honestly, I don't know if I've ever finished Super Mario World either. Like, because Mario games are, like, they're not games that I feel compelled to finish in the way, like, a Zelda I would really want to finish.
Obviously, they're not narrative experiences. Yeah. But I love the art of Mario World. Like, I was, when Super Mario Maker came out on the Wii last year, or Wii U, I found that there are four art styles in that game you can make levels with, and the one I found enjoying the most was Mario World.
Yeah, because that's the right one.
Absolutely. And so I've been kind of in the back of my mind, like, when I have time, I want to play Mario World. And I've had it on my Wii U for a while. And so finally the other day, I just sat down, like, I'm going to play Mario World. Like, I've gotten through about as much of Hitman Episode 5 as I want to play.
Right.
Forza Horizon 3 I can take a break from. It's not a narrative kind of thing. So I'm like, I'm going to play some Mario World. That is such a phenomenal game. And I know I don't need to tell you guys this. But it's just, like, for me as a Mario fan, it's almost kind of nice for me. It's like, I have this classic one I'd never played until now. I'm almost glad I waited.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, I didn't have a Super NES as a kid.
Yeah.
The only re-release it got for a long time was on the Game Boy Advance, and I don't think I ever had that one on the GBA. I had some of the other ones, but I never had that one. So this is, until I had, like, the Wii U and the Virtual Console stuff, I couldn't really play it. And so it's really fun to play that game. That game has such amazing art. It's like, why can't launch games be that good anymore? It's such a it's such a funny thing to consider that Mario World was the launch game for the Super NES, and it arguably looks better than any Super NES game afterwards.
Yeah.
You know?
Which is, like, that is not how that works anymore. There are a lot of reasons why that's not how it works anymore, but it is really weird to think back to how much that has changed, where, like, if you look back to, like, compare, like, The Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion, which came out near the launch of the 360, and Skyrim, which came out near the end of the 360, it's like, holy shit, those games look like they came out on completely different, like, technologies, you know?
Yeah, no, and obviously the Super NES would go in different directions, and they did make some innovations. Things like, you know, Star Fox or original Super Mario Kart were trying very different things. Those don't hold up as well for various reasons.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just love that idea that Mario World is either one of or simply the best Super NES game, depending on who you ask. No one is not going to put it in, like, the top 10, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's that or Link to the Past are the two, I feel like.
Super Metroid, I think, also gets a lot of that.
I would say Super Metroid is the three spot there. I don't think...
I like it better than Link to the Past, but...
You're fucking crazy, then.
There's a lot of people who would say that.
Those people are wrong.
Super Metroid is great. Anyway,
Super Metroid is great! You're putting it next to Link to the Past, which is one of the best games ever made.
I think Super Metroid is one of the best games ever made.
But not more one of the best games ever made than Link to the Past.
Anyway, these are all games that look beautiful, great games. Love Link to the Past, too. But anyway, what I was saying with Super Mario World, it's that game has so much imagination to it. It's so fun. It is so different from other Mario titles, but I also, going back to it, I see how much of a missing piece it is for me and my Mario knowledge, because even though it was the last side-scrolling Mario game for a very long time until New Super Mario Bros., it introduced a bunch of sort of little things that became huge in later Mario titles, like there's 5 Yoshi coins to find in every level, and you can have a power-up stored in this one slot, and things like that that would become, I feel like, kind of standby staples of Mario games later on.
Yeah.
And they're pretty small parts of Mario World on its own. Of course, it introduces Yoshi. That's a big thing. It's got so many cool power-ups. I love the cape.
Yeah.
I love how the fire Mario works in that. It's such a great game. And I am so fascinated by the evolution in the Mario series of how, especially those early games, you know, 1 to 2 to 3 to World to 64, there's no downtime. There's no moment where they were like, we're just going to wing it. You know, we're just going to kind of phone it in, which most series have that in the sequels.
And Mario, I mean, Legend of Zelda does, Metroid does.
Yes. Like, lots of games do that. Like, Metroid Fusion is a great example. I love Metroid Fusion. Metroid Fusion is a good game, but it's very much, it's kind of a throwback to, like, Super Metroid or something.
Or, like, Metroid Prime 2 and 3.
Sure, yeah.
Like, whether those are, like, you love those games or not, like, they are very conventional sequels to Metroid Prime.
Absolutely. And you know, even when Mario has done conventional sequels, generally, they're very different. Like, Mario Galaxy 2 is a very different game from Mario Galaxy 1.
Right.
The only times I feel like they've really kind of repeated within the main Mario series is probably the new Super Mario Bros. Games.
And even if those are, I feel like counting those as the main Mario series is a bit questionable to me.
Well, yeah, and they're kind of their own thing. They're great, but yeah.
Yeah, like, that's not to sort of, like, put those games down, but I feel like there's a clear lineage of, like, the core Mario titles, and, like, that went to, like, 3D Land and 3D World, not New Super Mario Brothers, right?
No, totally. I mean, if you're looking at the upward trajectory.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Because New Super Mario Bros. Has become, like, its own sub-series.
Yeah, it feels like it was a spin-off.
Yeah. But they're great. I mean, it's so anyway, playing Mario World, I think I've finished 4 worlds. I started playing it last night. So good. Such a good game.
It's a very good game.
I know, again, I'm preaching to the choir here, but it's just like, it's fun when you go back to a gaming classic that you know is a classic, but just no one has played all the classics. And, you know, there's ones you haven't played and you go back to it and it's like, I also love when it holds up completely. Like, it's one of those games. It's like seeing an old movie that just, it's like, this has not aged. This is perfect the way it is. That's one of those.
Yeah, I think Super Mario World, if, like, for people who, growing up now, who never, like, played the old Mario games, like, I think Super Mario World is the one to go back to, because I think Super Mario Brothers 1 is interesting, but there's a lot of stuff about that game, just in terms of the structure, that hasn't aged well, you know? Like, I mean, like, you can't even scroll back left in Super Mario Brothers 1 and stuff like that. And Super Mario Brothers 3 is a very, very good game, but it also feels kind of aged. Whereas, like, there's stuff about the structure of Super Mario World that still just sort of works. You know?
Absolutely.
That still feels like the way that Super Mario World was made back then is the way that, like, a platformer today could be made.
Well, yeah, because New Super Mario Bros., I think, takes the most from Mario World of the original 4. So, very much so.
Yeah, so, like, in those sort of, like, the basic structure of the game does not feel dated to me at all.
No. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. You can... One of the nice things about the Wii U Virtual Console is that sometimes they are willing to re-release different versions of games. So you can get the NES version of Mario 3, which is, you know, if you're interested in gaming history, it's good to play.
Yeah.
The best version of Mario 3, just as on a tangent if you're going to play it, is the GBA remake, which was one of the Mario Advance games. And it's based on Super Mario All-Stars, but with some enhancements. And you can get that on the eShop on the Wii U too. So if you're in, I was just going to say, like, you know, Mario World is just Mario World. Like, it's its own thing. They have never had to, like, re-overhaul it heavily. Although you can get the GBA version of that too on the Wii U. I don't quite know why you'd want to, I mean, for fun on the side, but it doesn't heavily overhaul the game or anything.
Right.
The GBA version of Mario 3 is fantastic. So I'm just going to point that out too.
Have you ever done, like, the Super Mario All-Stars versions of those games?
Other than,
like, because I've always, like, I like the All-Stars version of 3. I've never been able to play Super Mario Brothers 1 All-Stars. Like, something about that art style for Super Mario Brothers 1 feels wrong to me. I can't do it.
I like that art style. If I were to sit down and play the whole game, I do feel like I have to play the original art style just because it's so tied to what that game is to me.
They, it just... the All-Stars version just looks like a completely different game.
It does, and I think if you take it on its own merits, it's very nice. It basically, it looks like the Mario World version of one, and I like that if I can separate myself. I do have moments where it's like, I know this level so well, having the big overhauled graphics is difficult.
Like, yeah, it's something where I can't deal with it. There's like a psychological thing where it's like because even though I know it's not this, it feels like it's a weird ripoff of Super Mario Brothers 1 instead of Super Mario Brothers 1. Like there's just something bizarre about it.
Yeah. No. Mario Brothers 1, great too. It's as you say, it's a weirder game. I love that game to death, but that's one I did play as a kid extensively because it was on the Game Boy Color.
Right.
And that is the best version of that game, I would say. It's maybe a little harder to access now, but it's great. Well, it's on the 3DS eShop. So
there you go. Yeah. You can, if you want to play old Nintendo games that you have and you are willing to pay money, there are means to do that.
If you're not willing to pay money, there's plenty of emulators for you too. But I like having the console and my controller and everything when I can. So anyway, that was fun to play that. And then I think, do you have any stuff to go with, or are we going to do most of that in the gaming review portion of this episode?
There's one thing that I don't have a lot to talk about. It's just like sort of just say that I'm watching it, is the Luke Cage show, which is the next Marvel superhero show, which came out on Friday, so a couple of days ago from when we're recording this. I'm only on episode 4, but I'm enjoying it a lot. I think it has, like, if you have enjoyed the other Marvel shows, you will like this one. It has some of the same sort of pacing problems that Daredevil and Jessica Jones had, but it also has a lot of the same benefits those shows had, of that it has a very unique, strong sense of itself and its identity. The acting is very good. The characters are incredibly well-written and well-acted. And the show has this life to it. And especially there's this incredible moment in episode 2 where Luke is talking to this character, Pops, who's this kind of like old guy who's running a barbershop in Harlem, who used to be this like guy who was like running in gangs, and now he's sort of like trying to keep kids off the streets and like kind of like keep them straight. And they have like this straight, like solid 5-minute conversation about who their favorite Harlem Renaissance poets are. And it's like, that's the kind of show it is, and that's awesome. And it's really cool.
I can't wait to watch it. I really want to. I haven't had time yet. The one thing holding me back from being fully enthusiastic is, again, the thing that it sounds like it's a 13-episode series that should be 8.
Yeah, and I'm only on episode 4, so I have no idea where it's going to go. But I do feel like every episode has been a little bit too long.
And I feel that about every single episode of Daredevil.
Yeah.
Every single episode of Jessica Jones, especially, because that one was like a 6-episode miniseries. They somehow stretched to 13. So anyway, I do wish, if Marvel announced their next TV show was 8 episodes, I would be unambiguously excited for it.
Yeah.
Or they said it's 13 and the first 7 are episodic. Something like that, you know, like where you don't have to stretch a story out over 13. It's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I am excited for it. Luke Cage was so cool on Jessica Jones. And then I love, everything I've heard is just, I love that they are turning so hard into the, it is a Harlem show.
Yeah.
It is a black perspective. It is something we have not really had in superhero media so far in film.
Yeah.
So, it's cool. Yeah. Got that. Got Black Panther coming out. It's good.
Yeah, like Marvel has been doing a lot to sort of turn around and be like, hey, black people are a thing. Like,
and women.
They read our comic books. They have read our... They've been fans of Marvel and our company since, like, our inception and... A lot of, like, if you go back and look at some of, like, the early Luke Cage stuff and the early Black Panther stuff, it comes across as very pandering. And they've done a lot over the Marvel as a company, has done a lot over the years to sort of, like, bring black creators in on those properties and sort of, like, turn it into something very different and kind of that feels very special in a way.
Yeah. I mean, fuck, Ta-Nehisi Coates is writing Black Panther right now.
Yeah, yeah. I'm waiting for that to end because it's I want to get all the trades because that's how I read comic books, but...
Yeah, there's a couple of ongoing comics. I don't read a lot of comics, but there's a couple of ongoing ones right now I'm waiting for trades on the same in New York. Because it's like, I think there's some good, like, smaller stuff going on like that. So anyway, cool. Anything we want to say about Destiny following up on last week? Because we reviewed Rise of Iron.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're still playing it a little bit. Anything new to add?
Not really. Like, I still haven't gone into Crucible just because, like, since I've been doing other stuff, the most I've been playing Destiny is, like, you know, do the Daily Heroic Mission and then go into the Strike playlist and mess around with that a little bit. You know, I don't think I'm going to end up spending a huge amount more time with Rise of Iron past this. Like, it's something that I can kind of just dip into when I'm feeling a little bit stressed out and just kind of zone out and shoot some Fallen and have fun.
Right.
And that is exactly what I want Destiny to be when I want Destiny to be that. So,
yeah.
Like, but yeah, it's not like my opinion on Rise of Iron has not changed or anything.
Neither here. I've enjoyed more that I've played. I've done some more of the sort of questing and things like that. I do think a couple of things have come clear to me of just things I wish they had done better in Rise of Iron. Like, mm-hmm. The one thing I would say is there's a place in the Plaguelands called Archon's Forge.
Right,
it's
yeah.
It's a really cool challenge area. It baffles me that that's not split out into its own sort of Prison of Elders thing with matchmaking and stuff, because it's really cool, but the way it's set up now, it's kind of hard to access reliably.
Yeah, it's kind of like how the Court of Oryx was in The Taken King, where it's you just have to kind of go there and hope that other people are going to wander into the Archon's Forge and be willing to do this, like, sort of like impromptu event with you. Or if you're playing with other people, obviously you can just all decide to go to the Archon's Forge. But yeah, like.
But I always play with like my brother, so it's like two people. It's not really enough.
I haven't messed with the Archon's Forge thing much. I also didn't do the Court of Oryx much in the Taken King either. Just
Archon's Forge is really good. Like Court of Oryx was okay. Once you get it going, it's really good. So
yeah, I've had a couple of sessions where I like stumbled in there and was just like, oh hey shit yeah okay let's do this and just. Yeah. Sort of like group up with a bunch of random people and just throw down in there. But I haven't, since like most of the stuff I'm doing is in the Strike playlist, I don't even really go there anymore.
Yeah, so I think if I continue playing Rise of Iron, honestly, I'll probably play a lot of Crucible going forward and stuff like that, because that's really easy to just jump into and goof around with and not have to like worry about long quest lines or anything.
Yeah.
But it's a good game.
Yes, very good game.
All right, so let's go ahead and move on. I got a couple pieces of news for us to hit before we go to some of our topics. So let's hit the one that is most relevant for what we were just talking about, which is that Destiny 2, we've known it's a thing for a while, even though it's not officially confirmed, but they're going to make a Destiny 2. And this week, Kotaku, which, as they've joked a lot this week, it has turned into an official Destiny fan site.
Yeah.
I love their enthusiasm for Destiny over at Kotaku.
Yeah.
But anyway, they had a report. They got some sources on Destiny 2, a couple of interesting things just to highlight. They are planning on it being a totally separate game. Not that it's going to like throw out what Destiny is, you know, the core of it, but it will be a different game. It's not going to be you like transfer your character over and the space is over and it's just a big expansion pack. The way they described it is it's almost like, you know, think of Diablo to Diablo 2.
Yeah.
It's still Diablo, but Diablo 2 is not more of Diablo 1
or
something like that. So that's exactly what we were kind of hoping it would be, which is nice. Yes. And then also, it's going to be on PC. They're looking at PC development, so it'll have... They didn't say anything about, you know, maybe it'll have cross-platform play. They didn't talk about that. But it will be, in addition to Xbox and PS4, a PC game as well, which I think is good because Destiny belongs on there.
Yeah, and it's something where it feels like now that they have cut the ties to the old consoles and they don't have to like have people supporting four different versions of the game, that like... seems to have left room for like, okay, now we can do the PC version, because like releasing it on five different platforms is like, no matter how big your studio is, that's a huge amount of work.
Absolutely, especially when two of those platforms are so old, and then you'd also have to have PC. Like, I don't know how that would even work.
Yeah,
a game running from the 360 all the way to a high-end PC, I don't know if you can do that anymore.
Yeah,
so no, that's cool. I, you know, my brother and I have been doing some cross-platform play with Forza, and we're going to talk about that later. I would love if they could find some kind of way to have cross-platform Destiny play in the next version.
Yeah.
Just because that would be... Maybe even just between PC and Xbox, because there's such close ties there now. But otherwise, this report was nice, because it's like, that's literally, like, to the word what we were asking for last week.
Yeah, that it's like, we don't want... Like it seems like... What we wanted, and it seems like what Bungie is doing, is looking at what they accomplished with Destiny and like all the expansions and everything, and saying, okay, we kind of messed up a lot of like basic structural things about this project at the very beginning. We've done everything we could to sort of try to turn around over the course of it and learn everything we could, and now let's just like break everything down, look at it from the base, and like just rebuild it like from the base up and try to make it the best game we can. And that's what we want. I think like any big Destiny fan, that's probably what you want. Like, hopefully, it seems like the suggestion in the report was that there will be something that carries over in the sense of like, oh, you like who knows what it will be, but like maybe your character starts at level 5 instead of 1, or you get like your exotics carry over in some way or something like that. Or there's even a suggestion that maybe eventually some of the areas from Destiny 1 will come over to Destiny 2 with like the redesigned philosophy of Destiny 2 and that kind of stuff. So that all that would be cool, but yeah, the most important thing is to have the game be what it needs to be from when it launches and use that as a new platform from which to build up. And if that is able to support a Destiny 3 that is more of a straight expansion, but like a huge expansion than just a like another sort of reset, then that would be perfect.
Absolutely. I think from a business standpoint, it just makes sense because I do think Destiny is probably a little impenetrable to people right now.
Yeah.
I think getting new fans on board, you can do it, and I'd recommend, again, there's that collection out. If you want hundreds of hours of entertainment, you can't do much better than that, yeah. You know? But I also understand it would be really tough to jump into Destiny now with no real knowledge of it and try to get it all together.
Yeah, because there's also just weird things in terms of how the content has been retooled and accelerated and stuff as the new expansions have come out. That, like, there are certain areas of Destiny that have become sort of, like, retroactively obsolete, you know? Like, doing the Dark Below quests or something seem like something so quaint and weird and off on the side. And you have like, if you're playing Destiny from day one, you probably have no idea kind of like what those are and
right.
Why they exist and stuff like that.
Exactly. So you can get a unified package with Destiny, but it would be confusing. And with Destiny 2, obviously you want to bring in new people and broaden that base. And the best way to do that is a fresh start because, again, I think there are going to be some Destiny fans who are going to bitch and moan about this. But overall, I think that's what we all probably all want, which is that, hey, we've spent a lot of time with Destiny 1. We've loved it. We've been frustrated by it. It's been a good time overall. But it's okay to maybe start fresh again.
Yeah, and also, you know, like, the fact of the matter is that Destiny is not World of Warcraft in a huge number of ways. And one of the big ways is that your character in Destiny is not like your character in World of Warcraft. Where in World of Warcraft, you have like literally over like 100 abilities by the time you're at like max level, and there's so much content, so many quests, so many ways that your character can change with how you spec him out with the talent tree and all that kind of stuff, that like the idea of a like World of Warcraft 2 or something seems ridiculous when you have put as much time as one can put into their character in World of Warcraft. Whereas with Destiny, like the sheer way that the game is built and the combat is designed and everything is that like when the new expansion comes out and all of your gear basically becomes obsolete and you get all new gear and everything like that, like, there's nothing intrinsically about your character that's so important that it's like, your character might as well be a new character at that point, especially when you equip the new subclass and stuff like that. So I think, like, while there may be some people that are a little bit frustrated by the idea of their Guardian not being literally the same Guardian, although it might be in the story, it might still be literally the same Guardian in Destiny 2, who knows? But, like, for me, as long as, like, there is some indication that it's, like, it's my sort of contiguous experience and it's my story, I don't need, like, my subclass experience to carry over into Destiny 2 because who gives a shit? That doesn't do anything to identify me specifically to my character. Like, that's nothing, you know?
Here's a question, just because I'm curious about this sort of topic, just on speculation.
Right.
Does Destiny 2 even need to continue the story, or can it just be almost like a hard refresh and do its own thing? Like, I almost feel like that might also be an easier thing of just start from square one again. Ghost is going to go find a Guardian, but now we're going to have actual narrative around it. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if Bungie went in that direction.
Yeah, like, I think you could definitely do that. I personally would prefer if they, like, because I did, like, since they bungled it so hard, like, the lore stuff in Destiny 1, especially in terms of how, like, you're presenting it to the player, like, I think it's just, like, not even trying to do that for Destiny 2 and just, like, sort of getting on with it almost, I think, is the better idea. If, like, you don't, like, just have the ghost be there and, like, I would personally like it for them just to sort of imply that, like, your guardian, whether it's not, like, them, like, trying to refer specifically to events from, like, Taken King or something, but just imply that your guardian, who they are playing as Destiny 2, has been around and has been doing these things, and now you're going off on a new adventure. Like, I think that's all it needs to be.
Okay. Nice. You know what would be hilarious?
What?
If they decided Destiny 2 was set in the Andromeda Galaxy, and they called it Destiny Andromeda, and they got it out before Mass Effect Andromeda. Yeah.
I thought you were going to see what would be hilarious is if in Destiny 2 the Peter Dinklage voiced the ghost again, because I was just thinking about the ghost like coming and reviving a guardian. It's just like they go back, and then when the first Destiny 2 expansion comes out, they bring back Nolan North because they can't get Peter Dinklage anymore.
This time it's Troy Baker.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you don't want to just do the same thing over again. That'd be crazy.
I think what they need to do is that Ghost is Nolan North next time, but now he has a Ghost brother played by Troy Baker. And we can just continue this weird thing where they're always playing brothers, but now it can be really silly because they're both Ghost. Anyway, looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Destiny 2.
Seems like it should be pretty cool.
All right. Something that does not sound pretty cool is... Have you heard about this mini NES, Sean?
I have heard tell of a miniature Nintendo Entertainment System.
This was announced back around E3. And I think for whatever reason, we just didn't get to talk about it on the podcast.
I think we just sort of forgot because we were busy.
We were busy, yes.
There was a lot of stuff to talk about, and talking about a stupid mini NES was not our number one priority.
No, and we've made fun of this off the air, but I realized we haven't made fun of it on the air, and there was a bunch of news about it this week because... Okay, let's do the recap.
Okay.
If you haven't heard, Nintendo, this is the... It's not even a specific anniversary. Yeah, the 30th anniversary was last year. So I don't know why they're doing it, but this year, they are releasing in November. It's coming out, I think, November 11th or something. The Mini NES, which is this little thing you can buy. It's like a little console. It's got HDMI. You plug it into your TV, and it has hard-loaded on it 30 NES games. So, like 30 classic NES games.
You may have seen stuff like this that has been around for years of, like, a joystick with a button that has, like, Pac-Man and Galaga and Bosconian and, like Dig Dug on it and stuff like that.
Yeah, usually these are pirated things. There's a lot of these for the Sega Genesis specifically I've seen. Like, at Bed Bath & Beyond, you can get a Sega Genesis clone machine.
Yeah.
It's not officially licensed or anything, and it's got, like, 30 Sega games. And you probably don't want to get that. So this is kind of interesting because it's the first time like a company has officially done something like this.
And especially like a company as big as Nintendo.
Right. So you can it's not internet connected. You can't get more games on it. It's $60. You buy it, you get the 30 games, that's it. It's got an NES controller with it that you plug into the system, all that stuff. And I initially just thought it sounded so stupid because one, you can get all of these on the virtual console on the Wii, the Wii U, the 3DS, wherever you want it. Yeah. You can emulate them to your heart's content on your computer. The need for this product is so not there to me at all. So that's just sort of baffling. And then the more details that have come out, and especially ones that came out this week, it gets stranger and stranger because... So here's one of the first details we knew, and it was kind of reinforced this week because actual like reviewers are getting to play with it and stuff. And one of the things is the like wires for the controller are super short, like 3 feet long. So you could not put this in your entertainment center and then play it. The controllers are not wireless. You would have to have basically the console almost on your lap to play it. And if you want to access your, like, it does have save states and stuff, but if you want to access the save states, you want to look at your library of games, you have to hit a physical reset button again, on the console itself. There's no home button added to the NES. So really, this is clearly, you have to have the thing right next to you while you play, which I don't, I'm just thinking about like my entertainment setup. I literally don't know how I would do that.
Right.
Yeah. I would have to get a crazy long HDMI cord, and I really wouldn't want to. And again, I was never going to get this. It's just, I'm trying to think of like, who is this for and how would you use it? And it's just very baffling. You can... plug in, it sounds like, other Nintendo controllers. You can plug in a Wii Classic controller or a Wii U Pro controller. I'm not sure how that works. But those are, I know, at least the Pro controller, the plug is a mini USB, so you can probably get however long a cord you want. So that would alleviate it somewhat. But again, there's the reset button thing. So that's a very confusing thing about it.
Yeah.
But the games themselves have a bunch of emulation settings that are actually really good. So you can play it in like an old CRT mode, which is just for nostalgic fun. But you can also, like the base mode, which is in 4x3, looks pretty good, I guess. And then there's a pixel perfect mode, which just basically amplifies every pixel and makes it very clean. And what's weird is that the Wii U Virtual Console does not have that on NES games. Huh. And I actually did not know this. I didn't realize this until last night. I don't have any... I have a bunch of Virtual Console games on my Wii U. I have not had any NES ones. Actually, I did have one. It was Metroid. Metroid is a tough one to judge this kind of thing with because most of the game is just black.
Right, yeah.
So
yeah.
That's a tough one. So last night I was like, well, I kind of want to test this firsthand. What is up with the NES emulation on the Wii U? So I just bought Mario Bros., the original. It's $4, whatever.
Sure.
Yeah. And I realized I have like every other like Mario 2, 3, 4, 5. You know, I have all these other ones. I'm like, I should put it there for like my OCD. So I have all the Marios. And I was playing a little bit of it, and it's fine as emulation goes, but it does look noticeably kind of darker and just it doesn't look as vibrant as the Virtual Console for the N64 or the Super NES or the Game Boy Advance or even the DS. All of those look way better, and it's weird because the NES should be the easiest to emulate.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm thinking it's, like it's
old, like so you could fucking. I mean, you literally can emulate an NES on your phone,
right? So it's just. That was very strange to me because it's like, this is, I have better looking versions of this game. Even on my 3DS, it looks better.
Yeah.
And so that was very strange to me. And so the mini NES will, like, its selling point now to, like, I was seeing this report on gaming sites, is that it does look better than other official emulations. But then there's all these complications. So anyway, that's a long preamble to say, I don't know quite what Nintendo is doing with this. It's not like a, they're not like, we shouldn't make too much of this. This is not like their... This is not the NX.
Yeah, right? They did like come out at like E3 or something and be like, all we're showing is Legend of Zelda and this dope mini NES.
Yeah, so that's it's nothing to make too much fun of them for, but we can make a little bit of fun of it.
Like for me, my response is just looking at that and be like, huh. I mean, I remember I made a tweet about this when it came out. It was just like, hey, the NX is coming out like early next year if the indications are correct about it coming out like or being like coming out around March or whatever. And Nintendo, since the Wii, Nintendo has just, like, had this thing of, we have our virtual console, and you buy our games on a virtual console, and then, like, and we're just going to keep on repackaging our old, or, like, I mean, way before the Wii, because even, like, on Game Boy, and Game Boy Advance, and everything, just, like, here's our old games, you can buy them again, and 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 so now it's like, here's a mini NES, so you can buy our old games again right before we launch our NX, wherein we will have a new virtual console where you will be able to buy our games again. Because their virtual console shit's not probably not going to carry over.
It might. From Wii to Wii U, it did. You had to pay $1 for an upgrade, but you did not have to rebuy them.
Other than that $1.
Yeah. Other than that $1 upgrade, to be fair, that added a lot of stuff with the off-screen play and some of the emulation options that some of the games have. NES, for whatever reason, does not. So yeah. No, it is weird.
Yeah.
And it is like the Wii Virtual Console was actually pretty robust by the end of its life, and most of that still has not been released.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can get the original NES Final Fantasy, you can get Super NES Final Fantasy 2 and 3, all that stuff on the original Wii has never come back out. So it's just stuff like that that I hope it carries over one day. But yeah, it's just, as you say, I think the biggest thing is it's part of this sort of scattershot approach to the Virtual Console stuff and rebuying their games where they want you to rebuy their games, clearly, but it's never as easy as it should be in some weird way.
Yeah, and I feel like there's no faith in that, like, okay, if I buy Super Mario Brothers for the NES on, like, this, on my Wii U or my 3DS or whatever, that, like, I will just be able to play this again on the NX or whatever, like, new Nintendo console comes out. Like, unless there's a faith that, like, that's just going to carry over when it's like, it's a fucking NES game. It's an NES game. This game is like 30 years old at this point. Like, I should be able to play this game for a fucking quarter, you know? Like, that's, like, again, like, these, like, NES games are so old. And most, like, 99% of the NES library does not hold up at all to people who did not play games when those came out. So it's like, just, you know, just like, it's just a weird thing to, like, ask people to pay that much money, like, time and time again for these games.
It is weird, and I think the whole with the NES thing, I get on some level it's for people who don't own other Nintendo consoles.
Yeah.
But it would make even more sense to me to just put out a disc with, like, your 30 games or something. Like, Sega does that all the time.
Yeah.
Like, and that, I guess you don't have the flair of having a new little console to play with, but it's just like, I can't imagine who it's for, because most clearly it would be for kids. Kids aren't going to play NES games.
Yeah, kids aren't going to want this. They're too busy, like, making Super Mario Brothers in Minecraft.
Yes, exactly. Or Mario Maker or things like that that are much more appealing to them as modern Mario experiences. So, it's a very strange product. They also announced one for Japan. Japan's getting its own one, which is the Mini Famicom. They actually, I think, have a slightly better games lineup there, because a lot of them are Japan-only games.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny.
Yeah, it reminds me of, like, thinking about the games lineup. Like, most of the games lineup for the Mini NES seemed fine. The one that I looked at that was just like, who is seriously going to play the original NES version of Final Fantasy 1 on this thing? Like, who is ever going to do that? Like, that's a fucking 30-hour RPG. Like,
Yeah.
Who's not going to go, like, you could get a PSP for, like, $15 or something and download, like, the remastered version of Final Fantasy 1 that has better graphics and music and everything.
Yeah.
Like, who's going to play the original NES Final Fantasy 1 on this fucking thing? That sounds insane.
It does. I mean, I can understand going back to that for sort of historical purposes, but then I'm using an emulator. I'm using something else to kind of look at it from a historical perspective, but that's not what this is for.
Yeah.
There's also some weird gaps in the lineup. Like, it has Castlevania 1 and 2, but not 3, which...
Yeah, and who's going to fucking go back and play Castlevania 2?
I know.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so stuff like that is weird, but whatever. It's its own thing. I just wanted to make fun of it for a minute, because it's bizarre and I don't quite know what it's for, which, hey, Nintendo!
Yeah. Hey, you know, at least mini NES is really fun to say.
It is. Stardew Valley...
Yes.
You've
been playing it.
I have not played any this week, so I don't have anything to report there. I do have something to report.
Okay,
my God.
Great.
I have a news item with Stardew Valley. We'll talk about that in a minute, but I have to continue my story.
Because this has been one of my favorite ongoing segments in the podcast for the past couple of weeks, is your weird descent into Citizen Kingdom with this fucking Stardew Valley game.
Do you want to recap from your perspective where we were in the story?
So basically, you had amassed a massive farming empire in this small town called Stardew Valley, where you're reaping in like millions of dollars, and you have like 40 billion horses or something that you go and pet every single day because you're a weird creep and you like have this insane capitalist opposition to hiring anybody, and all the time you've been this total dick just riding into town on one of your mini horses and going and wooing the like lady who works at the cashier basically 7-Eleven, and then eventually now she has married you for your money and you have like this loveless marriage at your house. And if I remember correctly, you got married, and so you're trying to get it on and have a kid, or she wanted to have a kid, but when she said it, she was like, hey, can we adopt a kid? And you're like, what do you mean? Do we want to adopt a kid? No. And then next night she's like, but seriously, do you want to adopt a kid? And you're like, what the fuck are you talking about? And so I think that's where it left off.
I really want someone to make a Stardew Valley based on, like, your description of only having heard me talk about it.
I want, like, the Martin Scorsese, like, Wolf of Wall Street movie, you know?
Exactly. I'd love that Stardew Valley by Martin Scorsese.
Yeah.
Yes. Anyway. So, I have an update about Abigail and the kid.
Okay, great.
So, again, to recap,
Did you end up adopting the kid? I don't remember.
So, here's the thing. The way the system works in the game is that once you're married, you go to bed, and there's a chance that... after a few weeks of marriage, every night there's a chance she will ask you if you want to have a kid.
Right.
And the system is supposed to be, you can have same-sex marriages. And of course, same-sex couples cannot biologically have kids, so they would ask to adopt.
Right.
Makes total sense. But normally a heterosexual couple would have a kid. You know, they would say, do you want to have a kid?
Unless there is some other extenuating circumstance, which does not seem to be something in the game of, like, your character being like, oh, by the way, I'm impotent, so we have to adopt a kid.
Exactly.
I got too close to the nuclear power plant in the old city I lived to, or lived in. It's a long story.
So anyway, I was very confused when Abigail, like 2 weeks after getting married, she asked me if we wanted to adopt. And so I said no initially, thinking it was a glitch and that maybe later she would ask if we want to have a kid proper.
Yeah.
But no, 2 weeks later, she then asked again, do you want to adopt? So I'm just like, well, last time I said no, you laid in bed all day and I got sad. So yes, we can adopt. I'm feeling like this is probably a loveless marriage. I'm not really into this, but let's do it. I should probably have gotten a prenup. This is bad for my farming empire, but whatever. So that happens. So here's the update, Sean.
Okay.
About 2 weeks later, because again, I should say weeks. The game, clearly, you have like each season is like a month, but it's supposed to stand in for more time.
Right.
Of course, because babies don't come along in 2 weeks.
No.
But anyway.
That's not according to the biology class.
So here's what happens, Sean. It comes to the day when we're going to get our baby. Yeah. But instead of the adoption system happening, in the night, I go to bed and it says, in the night, Abigail gave birth to a baby boy.
What?
And so the next morning we have a baby and everything.
That's not your kid.
I know!
That's not your
kid.
This
is fucked up! Clearly what happened is the game glitched and said the adopt thing when it really meant to say, do you want to have a kid? So something went wrong on that end. But ignoring the glitch in our weird narrativization of all this, she asked if she wanted to adopt, and then she probably went into labor, and she didn't, like, mean to or something, and she was going to try to hide it from me, and then say, look at this baby we adopted.
Which is a very bizarre, convoluted plan.
It is.
But,
it's the only way I can explain it.
Yeah, it's pretty insane.
So she just, I didn't even know she was pregnant. It was just randomly in the night, she went into labor and gave birth to a baby.
Yeah.
So now we have a baby, and I feel like in the house, it's very cold now.
Yeah, is there anyone else in the town that you think might be the father?
Not really.
Huh.
Abigail has this weird thing where she loves hanging out in graveyards. It's like her weird character trait.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, I've hung out with her a couple times there. I'm wondering if she hangs out there because, like, someone else is getting something on the side. I don't know.
Who knows? Yeah, that's the graveyard's a weird place to go, I guess.
But, I, you know, no one would go to look for you there. You're cheating on someone. You wouldn't check the graveyard. It does make sense.
That is a fair point. That is not, that is, if I was being cheated on, that is the last place I would look to be like, where, what's going on? Where are you during the day? Would like I can't figure out where you ever are. It's like, oh, you're at the fucking cemetery?
Yeah.
I mean, literally the fucking cemetery.
So anyway, it's very bizarre. But yeah. But here's the thing. Stardew Valley just had an update, and I wanted to mention this.
Okay.
You can now, and it has not like rolled out to everyone, it's a beta update, so it's just in the news. I have not played this yet. There is an option now. You can divorce your spouse in the game.
What happens to the kid?
So here, I'll go through the whole thing. Okay. So basically, you have to go talk to like the town mayor dude and say, and you pay him $50,000.
Okay.
And then you can divorce, and you have until...
Is that how divorce works? Do you just go to the mayor and like hand him some money under the fucking desk? He's like, I'll take care of it?
I guess so. It's very strange. But you have, and he'll even tell you, he'll say you have until the end of today to change your mind if you want to back out of this. But if you don't, then you wake up the next morning and your spouse is gone. They've gotten kicked out, and when you get married, wherever your spouse came from, like whatever house they live in, their room becomes part of your house, like they move all their stuff in. Okay. All their stuff is gone, all that stuff. But you get custody of the kid. The kid stays with you.
Okay, what the fuck,
and so, dude? But your divorced spouse is now back in town, and they're really mad at you, and so it's very awkward, obviously.
Yeah, because you have somehow, like, I don't know how you divorced her, but, like, clearly you didn't go through any sort of legal proceedings.
Yeah.
Like, she needs to go to, like, the feds or something to get her fucking kid back.
It's very disturbing.
Yeah.
And here's the best part, Sean. If you really regret it, you can go talk to the town wizard, which is the whole thing in the game.
Okay, this is going in a weird direction.
And pay him $25,000, and he'll create a potion for your old lover where they will forget all of your time together, and it will reset everything, and you can start romancing them again, and you can get married again,
and,
but you'll still you'll still have the kid.
Can you have another kid now?
Yes.
What is this game? Like, we've just been goofing this whole time, sort of, like, having fun. It's like, ah, ha-ha, it's like Citizen Kane. It's like this weird, like, story about, like, the terrors and horrors of capitalism in modern society. Somehow it actually seems like it's leading in that in a weird way with this town wizard bullshit and magic potions.
It's very creepy. It's become a very interesting domestic simulator.
Yeah, like, it seems like the whole game has changed at this point for you.
It's very strange.
Yeah.
But, I haven't played a lot lately. I don't know how to feel about the kid.
Your kid's apparently been sired by a ghost, so, yeah. You know, I would be a bit disturbed by him as well.
Indeed. All right, let's go ahead and talk about some other games, Sean.
Okay, yeah, I'm just certifiedly creeped out, so let's move on.
Let's talk about something more unambiguously fun.
Okay.
Which is Forza Horizon 3.
Yes.
The first of the games we're going to talk about this week.
Forza.
As I said before, Forza Horizon 3... phenomenal game. I'm not the only one saying this. It's got just unanimously across the board great reviews and stuff. And I was excited. I was just, my interest was piqued at E3, where they showed just a very confident, cool demo. And it kind of came out of nowhere. Like, we knew where they were making the game.
Yeah.
But then, like, to see, like, you can hear it's in Australia, but then you actually see it and they're like, oh, damn, they went to town on this.
Yeah.
And it just looked really cool. And it's like, you know, I like racing games, but I don't play them much, in part because a lot of racing games kind of feel very rote and stale to me.
Yeah, like the mainline Forza Motorsport series has always had that kind of a feeling to me of it being kind of just like dull, you know, unless you're someone who's really, really into cars. Well, there's nothing for you there.
That's what I was going to say, is like, I think racing games kind of go in one of three directions. There's the kind of the kiddie fun kart racing kind of thing, which is its own thing. There's, on the far other end of the spectrum, there's the simulation racers, which I'm not really into because I like the more arcadey stuff.
Yeah.
But I feel like most racing games that come out these days are either those kind of heavy simulation racers, or they're more kind of in the middle and they're arcadey, but they're pretty dull, which is what I think a lot of the Need for Speeds are, things like that, where they're like, they're okay, but they have certain design problems. They feel like they're kind of slashed together really fast.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a problem with, you know, sports games or a lot of first-person shooter titles. It's one of those sort of evergreen genres that, because of that, it's kind of tough to have really super inspired landmarks, you know? But Forza Horizon 3 looked really good. And then there was that demo a few weeks ago, and I played that, and I'm like, damn, this is really good. And then I got all those reviews, and I'm like, okay, I'm in. I'm going to buy the shit out of this game. And it is so good. It is so good. I don't even know where to start. The most obvious thing to talk about is the graphics. It is an unbelievably beautiful game. And I talked about that a little bit with the demo, but now having played a lot of the game and been across the whole continent of I almost said Antarctica. That's not right. That could be the next Forza.
That would be a fucking awesome game.
Yes.
I want to just race with penguins.
All the fans you get are penguins. It's great. All your festival sites are just filled with penguins waddling around. It'd be great. No, Australia, the continent of Australia.
You might as well be Antarctica. They're basically the same place.
It is just a stunningly gorgeous game. Like, I think we would probably agree, so far this generation, the best looking game is probably Uncharted 4.
Yeah.
And I would say this compares very favorably to that. Like, in some ways, like, I'm starting to see this trend with games developed exclusively for this console generation, where there's just a depth of, like, color richness and what they can do with the lighting and fine detail and foliage and things like that. There's just a sense of texture and, like tangibility to the graphics that I didn't realize was kind of missing in 3D games before, but I'm seeing that now. So I would say Forza Horizon 3, easily the best-looking game on the Xbox One, and compares favorably to the best-looking game on the PS4. So, if you're just into good graphics, this game is for you.
Yeah.
And I said this during the demo, and it remains true, if this game were nothing more than you having some fun cars to drive around in and just explore cool simulation Australia, I would be into that, because, again, this is a lot cheaper than going to Australia.
Yes, tremendously so. And there's far less risk of you being attacked by some sort of poison scorpion or something.
Absolutely. Far less risk. Yeah. Yes. But it is so much more than that. You get that, and the graphics are beautiful, and their rendition of Australia is an absolute joy just to move around in. And I do want to say more on the graphics later, but I don't want to harp on it too much up front, because I think it's easy to get lost in that and miss how much else the game is doing well. My fundamental takeaway from Forza Horizon 3, and if you don't know, Forza Motorsport is the main series. Those are their, like, simulation racers. So if you're hardcore into that kind of thing, those are for you. I'm sure they're very good. But Forza Horizon is, like, their spinoff, which is more arcadey and devoted to just sort of having fun with racing. And I've played a little of Forza Horizon 1 because they put it on 360 backwards compatibility and had it on Games with Gold, so it was free. And that was pretty cool, but it's like, you know, there's a new one coming out. I'm not going to spend a ton of time in this. And really, the goal of those games, as I said, is to just have fun with it. And the way Forza Horizon 3 throws itself into that goal so completely is nothing short of admirable. Like, every single corner of this game is, like, meticulously, lovingly crafted for you to have just the best time possible. It is I have not seen a game in years that was this purely devoted to just you having crazy amounts of fun.
Right.
And it's hilarious. Like, all the you basically arrive in Australia as the new boss of the festival, and all the characters in the game, their sole purpose in life is to make sure you have a good time at this racing festival. Like, you have this assistant, and she's just like, we're going to open a festival here, and then our scouts will find all these cool things for you to do, and I have set up this bucket list challenge, which is a list of things you can do, and there's like 50 of these. I've only done like maybe 20 or something. But they're different challenges, and they're called bucket list events, because they're like super cool things, like drive across the outback in a Ferrari or something like that. And like, there's challenges involved, like do it in a certain amount of time. So there's a challenge aspect to it, but mostly it's just like cool wish fulfillment fantasy stuff. You have this other guy who's at your festival who's like a mechanic, and he goes around and hears about different barns that are abandoned that have old classic cars, and you have to go find the barn, and then he'll restore the classic car for you, and you just get it for free, and you can drive around in like a classic Chevy in the outback, and it's just cool, or in the rainforest or something. And there's races, and there's street races, and there's head-to-heads, and there's so many different events to do, and they are all tailored in such a way that it really is about having fun. It does challenge you. It can challenge you. You can customize the game to your heart's content in terms of difficulty, in terms of controls. Like, I play it basically default, which is as a very arcadey racer. In fact, I love how simple it is. It's basically four buttons. You have your triggers, which is, you know, accelerate and decelerate. You have the A button, which is your handbrake, and then you use the left stick to move. And that's it. And there are a couple of other supplementary buttons. Like, you can use the right thumbstick and get, like, different views on your car, kind of like in Grand Theft Auto, I forget what button that is, but Grand Theft Auto does something similar.
Right, right.
And then you can use RB to change your view. So, like, you can go first person, you can go on the hood of the car, you can be right, way yeah. back. There's a bunch of customizations.
The camera view that's on the hood of the car, that where, like, you don't see any of the car, that's, like, the most terrifying thing in the world.
It is.
It's just, like, it feels like you're just going to constantly die as you're doing
that. It
does.
It's fun to do in this game sometimes, yeah. though. And if you, by the way, if you're playing Forza Horizon 3, and I realize because my brother had not done this, and you have not played, like, first person in the actual driver's seat, absolutely do that for at least a little bit, because it's so cool. There's so much detail
yeah.
put into the interior of those cars, and, like, if you hit a tree, your windshield cracks and things like that. And you have a rear view mirror that is accurately showing you what's behind you and stuff like that. It's just, again, there is no corner of this game that is not lovingly, meticulously crafted. So that's a really fun thing to do. But anyway, I play it very arcadey. You can change it to be not automatic transmission and you have to manually change everything.
You can just take off all those assists way that, like, in Forza Motorsport you can. Because it is the same kind of, like, engine and everything.
Right.
So if you are someone who wants that, like, really in-depth experience, you can get that out of this kind of game.
Absolutely. And then you can change the races to be a little more in-depth. I'm sure you can, you know, there's this rewind feature that I'll talk about in a minute. You can probably turn that off if you want. There's a bunch of customization. So you can make it whatever you want it to be. But again, in its default form, it's not so much about challenging you and making you, like, frustrated with, which I do think racing games can run into way too often.
Yeah.
Just like a sports game can be like, I'd like to win sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like in this, like, maybe it's too easy for me sometimes and I should bump up the difficulty, but fuck it. The point of Forza Horizon 3 is I'm in the fucking, in Australia, in the outback, in the rainforest, and I'm racing, and goddammit, I want to win.
Yeah.
So, you know what? If they're going to kind of, like, everyone else is kind of, like, being paid off to, like, stay behind me, whatever. It's my fantasy. It's
yeah.
my dream world. And that's kind of how the game approaches everything, and I love that about it. It's so effortlessly just allows you to have fun. And there's just so many little, like, quality of life things. Like, when you're driving around, you have this assistant named, voice assistant, like your Siri in your car,
right.
called Anna, which is some weird acronym, and I love whatever it stands for because it's funny. But you can just bring up Anna at any point while you're driving. You just use the D-pad, and there's a bunch of options. You can have her, you know, set a waypoint to the nearest race or the nearest PR stunt or bucket list challenge, whatever. Or you can just say, Anna, find me something to do. And it's the first option. She'll just say, like, hey, there's something you haven't done over here. You want to do it? And you'll say, sure. And she'll give you a waypoint to it. Just those little kinds of things. Like, the game really wants you to just explore and have fun and have a good time. And it has the mechanics and it has the systems and it has the know-how to really allow you to do that. To a level that I think in this kind of game, I don't know if I've seen before. Like, there are systems in this game I wish other open world games would implement. Like what I just mentioned, like, hey, we should go over here and do this. Assassin's Creed needs that.
Right, yeah.
Grand Theft Auto needs that.
Like, yeah, instead of having to stop every, like, 5 minutes and dump it to the map and be like, okay, where is this, like, other thing? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Because, like, definitely I think there's a point where I'd want to try to complete everything on the Forza Horizon map, but I don't feel, like, stressed about it the way I do playing Assassin's Creed or GTA or these other open world games. Because, again, it's just, like, you have all these options, but the point is to just do what you enjoy doing and...
Yeah.
Anything you do in Forza Horizon 3 will get you points. It'll get you money. It'll get you fans. Basically, the way the game is set up is that everything you do, the base, like, experience is fans. And the more fans you get, because this is all about, like, a fake, you know, festival that you have, the Horizon Festival. And the more fans you have, you can open more festival sites, and you can get more events, and you can expand your festivals and stuff. And anything you do will get you some fans. It'll get you some XP. I even love stuff like, you know, you're driving down the road and you narrowly miss a car, you get some experience points for that.
A near miss, yes.
If you hit the car head on, you get points for that. It's like,
because fuck that guy.
Yeah. So it's just like, whatever you do, it'll give you rewards for, because it just wants you to have fun. And I think there's something kind of, again, like, admirable about that
right.
in a weird way, especially when the game can actually back it up and have the muscle behind it to do that. So there's tons of cars to get. I think the base game has something like 350. I already have a ton.
Yeah, and like the Forza, like, they have the licenses, so, like, they're actual cars. They're not just, like, sort of like fake knockoffs or something. Like, they have, like, all the licenses and branding and everything.
Absolutely. So they have all the cars. The cars are really cool. They drive. It's this is another thing. Like, with some racing games that get so kind of up their own butt with the details.
Right.
I'm not a car expert, so
no,
I can't I can't tell the minor difference between some cars. Forza Horizon 3 does do a good job where I do feel like the cars are differentiated, and if I see a stat difference, I'm going to notice that driving. And I think that's a small thing, but it's really important to note because it
yeah.
makes it... it's nice. It's like, well, I'm in my, you know, this car right now, and it's really good, but I kind of need to go faster on this stretch of road, so I'm going to switch to this car, and that kind of stuff is cool. And you can, you know, drive to your garage and change out your cars, or they can just deliver them to you for like 10,000 credits, which is not a lot. That sounds like a lot in the actual, right. For the amount of money you get in the game, you can fast travel however much you want.
Do they call them credits? Is it not like Australia bucks?
No, it's credits. It's CR. Huh. So, yeah. Not Australia bucks.
It should be Australia bucks.
What is the Australian currency?
Yeah, I was going to say it's not like insert Australian currency here, and then I realized I have no idea what the Australian currency is.
Kangaroos. Dingoes.
Sure, yes. Dingoes, koalas. I think those are all what they... I'm going to look this up while you keep talking.
Okay. Actually, this was kind of a funny story. Early in the game, there's a bunch of different... for the experience points, which is like how you level up, there's a bunch of different, like, little, you know, medals you can get. So, like, if you do, like what you just said, a near miss, that's, right. like, 500 points. There was, early on, I, like, did something, and I got a medal that was kangaroo for 1,000, and I was like, did I hit a kangaroo? Like, shit, that's really disturbing. And yeah. I realized, no, that's just for, like, a good jump they give you the kangaroo medal. But I love that, like, that freaked me out for a second. It's fun to imagine, like, what if Forza Horizon 3, like, you just hit kangaroos?
Are there kangaroos no. just sort of running around?
No. I think it's... bummer. I'm glad you don't hit animals. That would make me sad.
Yeah.
But,
Yeah, but I just looked it up, and I feel really stupid because the currency is just Australian dollars. That's all it is.
That's sad.
Yeah, they should call them ruse or something like that.
Absolutely, know? Just steer into the stereotype.
Yeah, exactly. If you don't embrace your own stereotype, like what are you even doing?
Yeah, shrimps on the Barbie.
Exactly.
Exactly. No,
it's 100 shrimps on the Barbie makes a roux.
Exactly. I'm sure the Australian people would not be offended by that at all.
No.
Yeah. No. So it's all so much fun. One other thing to talk about, sort of in the single player stuff, I want to talk about online in a second is. The game has radio stations, as most driving games, open world games have these days.
Yeah.
Easily the best radio station system I've ever played in a game like this. It's a, like, it's not a ton of radio stations. It's not like GTA 5 where there's like 30
yeah.
and you never know what to do with them.
Yeah.
So,
it is like in GTA 5, it got a bit ridiculous when you bring up that wheel that's the radio yeah. station. And it's like so detailed. There's so many of them.
Yeah, there's like 8 or something, but they all have their own identity. The music they play is really good. Like, I enjoy it. I've discovered songs that I would like to, like, you know, put on my phone and yeah. listen to.
That's the ideal for me for a radio station in a game, is like it has a couple of songs that I know really well and then a bunch that I don't, but are songs that I really like and like help me discover stuff I don't know about.
Yep, and the songs are really good. They fit with, you know, the game. And there are certain moments where they will tailor it. Like, they will start you in an event with a certain song playing, and it's awesome. And then there's other fun things, like they have their own DJs, and the DJs just have so much personality, and there's funny things going on, and they will directly talk about sort of what you're doing in the game and recent events. So all of that is just very well done. My favorite radio station has probably become the classical station.
Sure, that's always, it's a classic for a reason.
But, like, it's got really good classical music. It's not sort of just exactly what you would expect. Like, you're right. going to recognize the songs, but it's not completely hit you over the head obvious.
It's not just Ode to Joy over and over again.
Yeah, I think they do have that symphony that has Ode to Joy in it, but they have the full, like, 30-minute version.
Okay, good.
In fact, it's really funny. Yeah. There's this perk you can get where the radio stations will sometimes play what's called a skill song, and that just means that while that song is playing, you get double XP for all your tricks and stuff.
Right.
And a skill songs can also come up on the classical station, and one time it came up on the Ode to Joy piece, which was, so I had a 30-minute skill song.
Nice.
It was hilarious. But they had that whole thing, and the DJ on the classical station is hilarious because he has utter disdain for the whole racing thing. And it's like, you remember, like, oh yeah, even in this Racing Australia, there's other stuff going on.
This is cool. So each different radio station has a different DJ?
Yes.
That's a nice touch.
And they're very, like, unique, and it's really cool. My other favorite station is Pulse. That person is awesome who does that, the DJing there. But, like, yeah, classic. Like, I have had some amazing moments of where, like, the song from 2001 will come on
right.
while I'm going 300 miles an hour, and it's just like, yeah. This is great.
Yeah, the classical station in Burnout Paradise also was one of my favorites for just like, because yeah. it's, you know, it's you generally expect it to be some sort of like hard rock kind of song because it usually fits the car thing. But then every once in a while you switch to the classical and like it just changes the whole tone of everything. And it makes it even more ridiculous in some ways.
Yep. I actually have a clip I uploaded to YouTube, and I'll probably link it with this episode just because it's a funny clip. It's like, you remember in Casino Royale when James Bond flips his car like 100 times?
Right, yeah.
That happened to me in Forza the other day.
Nice.
But it happened while I was driving through the rainforest at like 200 miles an hour, and the song on the radio was Dies Irae, which, okay, yeah. If you don't know, that's the song that plays at, like, the beginning of Battle Royale.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, like, super epic, and it was just so funny, I had to just, like, record the clip, and I uploaded it so I could share it. But it's, moments like that are just kind of magical, and I love the radio stations for that. And then in terms of online stuff, holy cow, this game does online well. And awesome. I don't get to say that much anymore.
Right.
Because online stuff often annoys me, especially in open world games.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we're going to talk about Hitman later, and maybe we can touch on the one thing I hate about Hitman, which is the online bullshit attached to that game.
Right, yeah.
But, like, the way Forza does it is so smart, where if you go, there's a couple different online modes you can do, but when you go online, it doesn't put you in a different instance. You are just in your world on your box, and it syncs the things in the world. Right. So if you go online, it syncs what's called the drivatars, which is the big thing in Forza, where all the drivers in the world are populated by basically profiles from other racers and other players.
Yeah, it's sort of AI that is sort of designed to sort of try to emulate whatever this actual person's racing style is.
Yeah, so it'll just sync that, it'll sync other things, but it doesn't take you out and make you reload.
Right.
I've never seen that in one of these games. It's really smart, because like I couldn't help but compare it to Grand Theft Auto V. Which right, has
yeah.
the shittiest matchmaking online system ever in any game in history. It's the worst. And when you actually get GTA 5 online working, it can be kind of fun. But the headache of getting it to work with, like, I want to play with a friend.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, God, this is going to take 3 hours just for loading.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stuff like that. It is a nightmarish mess. And Forza is so easy. Like, I was expecting the kind of mild, nightmarish mess, because that's how open world online usually is. And instead, it's just my brother sent me an invite, I accepted, and nothing changed. Just a thing at the top of the screen said, all right, we're syncing drivatars, give us a minute. You go ahead and play around in the sand.
Nice, yeah.
Fantastic. And here's the other thing. So this is one of the first games with Xbox Play Anywhere.
Uh-huh.
So I bought the game, and my brother, on his Windows 10 PC, because he plays mostly on a PC now, and he has, you know, a really high-end PC, he'll still play Xbox when it's an Xbox game. But now that there's this Play Anywhere stuff, we thought, well, it'd be really cool if we could do the cross-play stuff. And so he loaded the game on his Windows 10 PC. It was super easy to get, put it on there. It's got full PC customization. He says it runs really well, no real problems. The only problem I've heard is sometimes it doesn't keep a consistent 60. But that's still better than the Xbox version, which is 30, so it's still a higher frame rate. He's playing it in 4K and everything, says it looks gorgeous, so that was cool. But then with online, it was the easiest thing in the world. Like, literally, it worked better than most Xbox-to-Xbox games we play.
Right.
So we just seamlessly were online together. With the Xbox Play Anywhere, the party system works across Xbox and Windows 10. It's amazing. It's like, it's the best-case scenario for what this could have been.
Yeah.
Because we talked over the summer, like, this Xbox Play Anywhere stuff sounds like it could be cool, but, you know, there's all these...
Yeah, kind of, like, Microsoft has a history with kind of messing up the PC game stuff, so it was a big question mark back then.
But so far, it's kind of an unmitigated success, because
awesome.
ReCore worked better on PC than it did on Xbox. Yeah. And that's not a multiplayer game, so there's nothing else really to judge there. And then now Forza Horizon 3, totally seamless. I'm so impressed. And it works very well. The only thing is we're having a little trouble figuring out how I could send him an invite. But we still can get together. It's just he has to send the invite. It's fine. And I think that's probably just figuring out where in Windows 10 that even comes up. Because
right.
it's not an Xbox interface. But so far, like, really good. And the online stuff is cool. I've been mostly playing what's called online co-op. So that's where you get in a group with your friends. Or you can do some random matchmaking. And basically, you can start events together. You can just drive around the world. And anything you do, once you go back into single player, all your credit will carry over. And you just keep going. And it doesn't sort of mess with anyone's particular sort of instance of their world and their progress. It just contributes to your own progress, but you can do it while playing and racing together. And that's so cool. That's such a fun way to do it. And then there are other online modes where you can kind of be in more of a matchmaking thing. I assume that kind of works the same way. I have not played that extensively.
Right.
But because I like that there is an offline mode in this game. Like, it's a small thing. But, like, Need for Speed Rivals, which was...
Yeah, a disaster with its online stuff.
And that's all online. I feel like a lot of racing games and open-world games are going that route, where you just have to be online to play it for some god-only-knows reason. But, no, with Forza Horizon 3, it has online elements, like your drivatars and stuff, but you can just play offline and have fun. And that's good because, for instance, it's got that rewind feature, which is a big thing in Forza, where you can press Y, and if you messed up, kind of go back, see what you did, try it again.
Yeah.
It's really cool, and I think in single player, it's so core to what you're doing. And obviously, you can't do that in online, because it would mess a lot of things up.
Yeah, crazy.
No way to do that. So it's good. It's, you know, they've maintained that offline thing as it allows the series to maintain its identity. So I'm just so impressed by this game. Thomas and I, my brother, when we play this together, we're just kind of constantly in awe of it, that there is so much to do. If you like racing, that's great, and there's a lot of racing stuff to do. But if you really just want to be able to drive around and do fun things, I think you'd still like this game, because by no means is racing the only thing you're doing in it. There's lots of other car-related activities, and it's a blast. It is just a rock-solid game. It is as confident and polished a video game as I have played in 2016. And I would not have expected that one of the best games of 2016 was a racing game.
Right, yeah. It's from everything you said, it sounds to me like it is the a long time coming in terms of a successor to Burnout Paradise for like a like open world arcadey racing game that like actually nails it. And like, because ever since Burnout Paradise is an incredible game, and then after that, the Burnout like Criterion kind of like fell apart with EA and everything, and the Need for Speed was a more lucrative franchise, so like Criterion teams got split for like working on Need for Speed, and that never kind of really like made it up there. And then for a while, this generation has been like weirdly sort of sparse in terms of how racing games are, whereas like historically racing games are like, you know, a dime a dozen. Like there's just so many of them. This generation has been sort of sparse, and it's awesome to hear that Forza Horizon 3 is as good as it is.
So good. And again, on those graphics, just one last thing to say. The clouds in this game. I know that sounds like the most mundane thing in the world,
right,
but it's once you see the game in action, I don't know how they did it. I don't know what systems are at work, but it is a magic trick. The clouds.
They were saying it about the Xbox One since they announced the console. It's taking advantage of the power of the cloud, Jonathan.
I feel like we should just end the podcast there.
Yeah, sorry, I used that zinger too early.
No, it's okay. But no, it's the literal, you know, clouds in the sky. There's just, you know, usually when you see clouds in a video game, they're white and they're puffy and maybe they move a little bit. And that's fine because you're not going to pay attention to the clouds. But the thing is, in real life, I actually pay attention to clouds a lot because they're beautiful.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way like light plays off them and the color of the sky and the little nuances in color they have, from a photography standpoint and a visual standpoint, they're so fascinating. And they're actually, I think, a very hard thing to capture in photography, let alone animating them dynamically in a video game.
Right.
But somehow the team behind Forza Horizon 3 did it, and just the way clouds are generated and the way they move and the colors they capture and the way light breaks through them and the way they cover the sky in shadows sometimes, I have never seen anything like it. I don't even want to call it photorealistic because I think that's selling it short.
Right.
It's more artistic than that. It is so gorgeous, and it's just indicative of everything this game does on a visual level to immerse you in this very unique surrounding. Boy, I love this game.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, Sean, what do we want to talk about next? Do we want to do Virginia at the end, or do we want to do Hitman at the end?
Well, before that, I want to talk a little bit about Dragon Quest Builders.
Because
I played that demo, and there's stuff about that game I just kind of want to talk about before we move on.
Awesome. I think we were talking about this off the air. I forgot.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, Dragon Quest Builders is a game that I think it's already came out in Japan about a year ago, and it's finally coming out over here later in October. And so, they released a free demo for the PS4, and I think the PS Vita version as well has a demo that you can just get on the PSN. I highly recommend people just play it because it's a very interesting, weird game that like I've never really played a game like this. It's obviously it's pulling from the Dragon Quest franchise, which is like next to Final Fantasy, like the big JRPG historical franchise from Japan that never quite hit it big over here, but it has its fan base. But then the Builders thing is that it's this spin-off that's sort of drawing from Minecraft and Terraria and those kinds of modern sort of like building pseudo-survival games. It's much more emphasis on the building than the survival side of it. And it's a very interesting mixture. And, you know, I haven't played a huge amount of Minecraft, but I have played some Minecraft. I played a fair amount of Terraria back in the day when that was sort of a newer thing. And so I have some experience in this genre, and I've never seen a game quite take this tack that it feels a lot more structured than those games typically are, in that there is a story, or at least like there is in the demo, which is mostly like a very long kind of tutorial thing, because obviously these games are very complicated and have so many different mechanics that they have very long tutorials, but there is like story, there's like there are characters that are talking to you, and they're like, and you have little missions that you get of like, okay, I need to go and I need to kill like these five chimera things over here to get their feathers to come back here to craft a bed so that this guy can move into my town. But like the main thing that I love about Dragon Quest Builders is that story part and is the writing, because the writing, for what does not need to have like any writing at all, it has some of the funniest, most clever writing I've seen in a video game this year so far, in that it's just, it allows it to sort of like take the piss out of itself kind of at every single turn. And that the whole setup is that you're in this world where sometime in the past, the Dragon Emperor basically destroyed all of human civilization, and human civilization has crumbled, and humanity is sort of scattered around the world, living in like hollows and in rags and everything. And this goddess sort of like resurrects you or creates you, the hero, whose default name is Bildrick, which is the perfect name for him. So it's like, if you change that name, I'll never forgive you. Unless you change the gender. Bildrick sounds a very male name to me.
Bildrecka.
Yeah, sure, Bildrecka. You have to have Bild in the name somewhere, because you actually, you really should have Bild in the name somewhere. Because the goddess creates you and bestows upon you the ability to make things, because civilization has been destroyed, and part of, like, I think, I assume in the story you'll visually find out how this happened, but something about what the Dragon Emperor did means that people have lost the ability to create things. So, Bildrick is created, and you are, and the goddess specifically tells you, you are not a hero, you are a builder, like, you have these powers to build stuff, I'm going to send you out into the world, and you are going to try to like rebuild civilization and rebuild all this stuff. So you get sent out and you stumble upon this small like destroyed town that has like just like piles of dirt and rocks everywhere. And then you set this flag thing down that summons this like random human here that's like, I don't know what's going on. I just felt attracted to come over here. Like, who are you? What is this? And then you just go and you take your stick and you smash some dirt blocks and get some dirt and walk over to this destroyed house. And you just like, literally you just pile up dirt in the holes in the wall in the house. And then she walks up to you and is like, what did you do? Where did this house come from? What is building something? What are you even talking about? Because it's this world where, like, the sheer act of taking a stick and taking a rock and like putting them together to make an axe is like fundamentally just like not understood by the people. Like, it's gone. It's erased from like their like being as a human. And so your whole mission is to sort of like fix this town and get people to come to the town as the town grows, and you get new missions to go out and like find new recipes and build the town up. And I haven't even really finished the demo because I got kind of caught up playing other stuff, but like it's the setup is hilarious. I think I really like their sort of more simplified take on the building stuff, because it's a sort of top down, sort of isometric perspective that you can swing the camera around in any direction because it's all 3D, sort of voxely look kind of like Minecraft, but it's not first person or anything. So it's not, the building stuff doesn't feel as detailed as it is in Minecraft, but that sort of facilitates the more adventurous aspect of it, of you having these missions to build like specific buildings. That's one of my favorite things about the game is characters will sometimes come up to you and say, I want you, because I'm an idiot that doesn't know how to make anything. I'm just going to give you this like idea of like this plan of what a house I would want to be, and you're going to take this and actually like get like rocks and build this house. And so you can actually, you basically throw the blueprint on the ground of the world and just like fill in the spots where it is to make a person's like specific building that they want to be made. And then they go in and inhabit it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's just a very clever, funny game that also has just a very clever, funny take on the genre itself, both in terms of how it contextualizes it in the world, that I think is brilliant. Because again, it doesn't need to have that. It doesn't need to have this ridiculous premise where like people have forgot what building is, and so Bildrick has to come in and make everything for everybody.
No, but it is smart because it is, I love Minecraft. Yeah. Obviously, it's a great game. But I can definitely see the merit in a thing like that that has more direction and purpose to it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, sometimes with Minecraft, it's you have to have a certain idea and go at it, and then it can feel very grindy. I would love something like that with more narrative. And hey, if it's a funny Dragon Quest kind of narrative, sign me up.
Yeah, so it's something where I highly recommend people go and check out the demo, because obviously it's free and you can just spend some time in it. I have no idea if the full release game will have like legs on it that like if you will want to spend a huge amount of time with it or not, because obviously the demo is a very small taste of what the full game is probably going to be. But like it's something that like that is a game I went from knowing absolutely nothing about to now sort of like keeping my eye on in the future to like if there's a sale or something, maybe picking it up.
That's cool, because I've been keeping my eye on it because I was kind of interested in this, but I didn't know there was a demo, and I'm really glad there is, because that'll help me make a decision in the future.
Yeah.
It's a good year for Dragon Quest. Dragon Quest VII, the remake for the 3DS, finally came out in the US this month.
Cool.
So, or I guess last month, because now we're in October.
Yeah.
But, and I would be playing it right now if I didn't have so many other things to play, because I really want to. So that's a game I will definitely pick up at some point, because that's never... I think there's a PS1 version of it or something, but now it's finally out over here on the 3DS, and that would be fun to try, because I've never gotten to play a Dragon Quest game.
Yeah.
There was one on the DS back in the day, maybe one or two, but I didn't play those when they came out.
Yeah, I might be misremembering, and it might actually be a different sort of JRPG thing, but I remember playing some sort of JRPG that I think was like a Dragon Quest re-release of one of the early games on like the Game Boy or something.
Okay.
So again, like that's an old memory that might be completely wrong, but that's like my main touchstone.
Yeah.
Is that, and like I know what the Dragon Quest slime looks like. Like exactly. That's the main thing.
Well, and I just think Dragon Quest is cool because it's all designed by, the visuals are designed by Akira Toriyama of Dragon Ball fame, and God, his art is great.
Yes. So.
Anywho, so that sounds fun.
Yeah.
All right, so Sean, back to my question.
Right.
Do we want to do Virginia first or Hitman?
I have no idea.
I think, let's save Virginia for the end.
Because it's a weird game. I have no idea where our conversation's going to go.
Also, there's no real way to spoil Hitman.
No,
It's not really narrative heavy, although we have narrative stuff to talk about this episode.
Yeah.
But Virginia, I would say if you want to play it, don't let us spoil it first.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but we'll warn you before we get there. So Hitman, Sean, we've talked about the game before.
Yes.
You've been really high on it.
Yeah, I've been playing it since the Marrakesh map basically came out.
Okay, and I got it a couple weeks ago, and I did right before episode 5 came out, I caught up with episode 4. Which, what is that one?
The Bangkok map.
Bangkok, yeah. I forgot which Indian city it is.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to keep saying Mumbai. It's not Mumbai.
It's not Mumbai. It's definitely Bangkok.
Anywho, and I really liked that. Bangkok is the only map I have not like gone back and tinkered with more because I was like, oh, episode 5 comes out tomorrow. Okay, let's play Bangkok. Bangkok was good. Colorado, I think, was even better.
Yeah, so, this is a really good episode of this game. I'm constantly amazed at their ability to, while like it's still very like it's a Hitman game, it's a Hitman level, like it's not like they're fundamentally changing the game, it feels like their philosophy for how they design the level changes subtly each time a new map comes out, and like this Colorado one feels very different from all the previous ones to me.
Absolutely. And I have not like unambiguously loved every episode so far, but I have, just as you just said, I've been very impressed that, you know, Paris totally different than Sapienza.
Yeah.
And then Marrakesh is its own weird thing. And then the Bangkok one, I really want to go back and dive into it because that one is the most kind of like Paris and that it's kind of one building. But the way that one building works is very different.
Yeah, totally different because like Bangkok is like split down the middle vertically, whereas like Paris is like the stages of going up the building.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. But yeah, Colorado is a compound. And you have 4 targets this time. Normally it's 2. So you have 4 targets. You're on like a military compound, sort of in like this valley in the mountains.
Yeah, it's like a paramilitary thing of there. It's a bunch of people that are kind of up to no good.
Exactly. The first and most striking thing is, I don't know if you've sensed this either, it feels like the graphics in this game get more impressive with every level.
Yeah, yeah, it does. Definitely feels like whether it's they're like subtly like tweaking the engine and sort of like making improvements, or it's just like their art direction is getting better. But I definitely feel like, especially when I've gone back to Paris on some of the elusive targets, I still think the Paris, like, I think the game looks good generally all the time, but, like, there is the sense of, like, when you compare Paris to Bangkok, like, the Bangkok map, that hotel is just so spectacular looking, and the color in it is so spectacular, and then Colorado kind of has, like, the exact opposite effect, where it's, like, the Bangkok map is so lush and luxurious because it's this, like, brilliant hotel, and then the Colorado map is, it's, like, this dank, dreary day in, like, the mountains of Colorado, which, like, we are both from Colorado. That's where we're recording the podcast now. So, like, it's a scenery that I know very well, and it's just sort of like this flat compound with a bunch of buildings, and you know, but it's just, it's that sense of like the light and the dreariness of the weather, like it conveys something very effectively with the aesthetics.
Absolutely. We're talking about the clouds in Forza Horizon 3. Yes. These clouds don't quite measure up, but they're very nice.
Yes.
For video game clouds, I was impressed by these ones too.
Yes.
So anyway, like that.
Hitman also powered by the cloud.
Well, yes, because you have to play online for some god only knows reason.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll talk about that later. But no, so I have probably engaged with the Colorado map more than any of the others, just because I knew we were going to be talking about it.
Right.
And because it was the new one, I was like, oh, I get to catch up with the episodic thing now.
Yeah.
And just for a week kind of play. So I'm up to like level 17 in mastery.
Yeah,
and
I'm basically around there.
Okay,
yeah.
So we've both played it a number of times.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, the basic setup is, it's kind of funny. This is the episode where the narrative kind of kicks into high gear because...
Yeah, it's sort of, it happened at the end of the Bangkok map as they sort of set up the Agent 47 and his handler figuring out this sort of shadow client thing that the other maps were sort of like hinting at, but they hadn't made the connections. And so this is the first time like Agent 47 and his handler kind of know about the plot that has been going on in the cutscenes the entire time.
Yeah, let's start there. Just because it's such a small part of the game, but how do you feel this is the most heavily narrativized of the episodes?
Yeah.
Not that that really changes the actual gameplay. This is not a game that relies on narrative for its actual mechanics and stuff, but it does have the most... What do you think of the story now that we're one episode away from the end?
Yeah. I like it. Like, it's obviously, it's not a story-focused game. It's not Witcher 3 or something. But I think they're very smart about how they've been telling the story, especially if you've been playing it episodically, because there's a lot of very subtle stuff about, like, characters coming up in, like Jordan Cross gets name-dropped in the Paris map, and then he becomes a target in the Bangkok map. And there's a lot of connections like that, like Jordan Cross's father, who's like, he's like sort of like in with some of the Paris people, and he's like the person that the Shadow Client actually wanted to go after, so you killing Jordan Cross like makes him open. And so like there's a lot of small intrigue things that are happening that if you're paying attention to all the background dialogue with the kind of game it is, if you've been going through and playing the maps multiple times, chances are you'll catch some of that. Like, it'd be hard to catch all of them on all the maps. But chances are, you know, if you've been playing a lot and, like, you go back to do an elusive target or, like, a contract mission or something on Paris, you will then realize, oh, shit, I know what those guys are talking about because that's something that just happened in Marrakesh, or that's just something that, like, I just dealt with in depth in Bangkok. And then just the sort of very basic Jason Bourne, James Bondy kind of like intrigue plot of you're working for this assassination organization that is being manipulated by some weird like dude who's like the villain who knows everything behind the scenes, that if this was a movie, at some point he would be captured and then put in jail in their facility for some reason, but that would be part of his whole plan. He gets out, like, it's that kind of thing. But obviously I don't think, like, the game doesn't have much opportunity to do that whole plot structure, but that's the kind of sort of spy intrigue thing they've been going for. And I think, again, it's not something that's going to, like, blow your socks off in terms of, like, rich characterization or thematic storytelling or something. But as just a nice little thing that connects all of these really rich gameplay experiences together, I think that's been smartly done.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I think the way it's structured for Episode 5, I think you, on some level, do need some kind of escalation in the narrative for us to have an episode like this one where you have double the targets. It's a higher stakes sort of thing.
Yeah.
This is in some ways a harder map because of there's more stealth elements to it.
And, like, everybody is carrying an assault rifle, so there's very little margin for error if you fuck up.
No, if you fuck up, you're loading a
save. Yeah,
yeah, this is not one where you can run away and, like, hide in a closet.
Yeah.
Change into a waiter uniform. There's no waiters in this.
No.
Is this the first one without a waiter you can change
into? I think it is literally the first map that doesn't just have a waiter costume, that every single costume you get is like militia technician or like militia demolitions expert or like militia elite.
Exactly. So that's kind of fun. But no, I think it does that, and it gives you this sense of stakes going into it. And then most of the narrative in this one, as always, happens at the end. And because you kind of have this goal and this multi-tiered goal, I think that kind of helps the gameplay move along a little, you know, faster. And then, yeah, I am intrigued. I want to see kind of how they wrap it up in the next episode.
Yeah.
Some of the narrative is gobbledygook, and there's no way around that, but...
Yeah, but it's stylish gobbledygook, and like at some point that's kind of all I need for like it's just a framing device to sort of like piece things together and make things a little more interesting. And
I like bringing his handler Diana into it more. I love her voice.
She's so good. And like that was the one where at the end of the Bangkok map where you get that cutscene that kind of blew my mind when I realized that was her. Is like, oh my god, that's awesome British lady that's been talking to me the whole time. Because it's such a really great performance. That's, you know, all she's doing is delivering exposition all the time, but she does it with such a incredible flair that, you know, it really adds personality to the game.
She's like this game's Cortana or something.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, so.
Like, if Cortana was just, like, really cold British woman.
Yes.
That has a very dark sense of humor.
Dark sense of humor, and clearly 47 appreciates it.
Yeah.
Because he also has some kind of weird dark sense of humor, I think. So, anyway. But, yeah, let's get into the actual gameplay. So, like I said, you got four targets here. The Colorado map sort of... I don't know if it's actually smaller. It feels a little more compact and direct.
It feels very dense compared to some of the other maps.
Which I like, because there's something about the sprawl of some of them that I think gets a little too like big for me.
Right.
Like, I really love the prologue missions on the yacht and then on the little military compound. And this felt like a slightly bigger version of that compound tutorial one,
which
I think is actually very solid if you go back and replay it. It's a really good intro to the Hitman stuff. And this feels, like I said, kind of like a bigger version of that and a really fun version of that.
Yeah.
And so I kind of like that about it. But as I say, it's very dense. You've got this sort of house in the middle. There's also this sort of training compound. There's this little quarry.
There's like the demolition area. There's like the technician area.
Yep. But like after, you know, one or two playthroughs, you will get this one very fast. Whereas I can play Sapienza a lot. I'm never going to know all the areas in Sapienza, right?
Yeah. That is a big map that has like a lot of ins and outs.
But this is not one of those. And I think, I don't know, I think that's very exhilarating because it's very dense, but there's a lot of opportunity in there. And it felt like this one for me was easier to kind of engage with and get good at than some of the more sprawling ones.
I got that sense as well. And there's something, like, I think this was my most fun I've had on an initial playthrough on the maps. Because some of, like, my experience with some of the Hitman maps has been, like I think I felt this way kind of about Marrakesh and Bangkok was, like, the first time I played through it. I was sort of, like, I didn't really know where to go, and I got kind of confused, and I enjoyed it, but, like, there's, like, an element of, like, I don't know how good this map is, and then playing through multiple times, I was like, oh, okay, like, now I get how this map works. Now it makes sense to me. This Colorado map, there's something about having, like, the four targets and the way that the map is split into these distinct areas. Like, you know, like we said, like, there's the training area, and there's the demolition area, and there's the house, and there's where the technicians hang out, and there's the weird quarry with, like, the sludge water in there that you can dunk the one lady into. Like, it's, so there's a, like, I feel like the map is laid out in a way that there's sort of these distinct areas. And in general, each of the targets kind of stays around one of those areas, areas are kind of associated with one of the targets. And so that makes sort of like approaching the map on an initial playthrough, I feel like you get the sense of like, okay, I can just sort of like compartmentalize these tasks and be like, I'm just going to focus on getting this person. Now I'm going to go over here and get this person and this person and this person. And instead of like... some of, like, I think Marrakesh and Bangkok, there's a bit of the sense of, like, I'm juggling a bunch of plates at the same time on my first, or spinning a bunch of plates at the same time on my first playthrough, and don't really know in which direction I'm trying to go. Whereas, like, in Colorado, it feels like it facilitates you to be able to, like, focus on very specific individual objectives within the larger map.
I actually think if they can do it going forward, more than two targets is really smart.
Yeah.
Because I think one of the things that happens is if you have a really sprawling map, like, I found this on Paris a little bit. Not that Paris is sprawling, but there is a lot of space in that building. If you only have the two targets, their patterns can be very long, and it can be kind of a slog sometimes if you want to do something specific to figure out where in the pattern repetition you can do something, and it can be just a little too confusing and overwhelming.
Right.
And I never really felt that with Colorado because it's a little denser, as you said, but also with four targets and they have clear spaces, you pick it up pretty fast because everything's a little bit more... you know, they do intersect and whatnot because there's three people who will at different points go through that house.
Yeah.
But you will know where they go and where they belong and what you should do. And in some ways that made the sense of possibility to me feel more palpable than it has been in other episodes.
Yeah, I definitely got that sense as well. And it's something where it's like, I think as like I've been playing through all these different episodes and the way that they've been changing the design is like, it's helping me sort of like appreciate the philosophy of how these Hitman maps are designed, and that there's a sense of like, you know, each target kind of like in all the maps, but it's like it's the most clear in the Colorado map because there's so many of them and the map is so dense. Like each target has like the area they patrol and the area that's kind of their area. And the maps are designed in such a way that it's like your radius towards that area is like how intense it's getting. And the whole game is about like either infiltrating that space, that radius around the target. Or it's about affecting that radius around the target, or it's about pulling the target out of that radius to somewhere else. And so I love just like when you look at all the maps, the way they're able to play with that's how just naturally the objectives in Hitman have to be designed in terms of assassinating the target is that, you know, like in the Paris map, you have the one guy who sort of does his route around the kind of like the outside of the first floor of the map. But then it's like so much about Paris is getting up to the third floor, and like as you ascend, it gets more difficult. There are more guards. You need like better costumes, and then like getting into like taking out the target. In Sapienza, there's so much of it is like it's all about that house is this really strong focal point, and then you have the whole area outside that has all these different opportunities to pull targets in different ways, get different items that help you to infiltrate the house in different ways. Then in Marrakesh, it's like you have the two targets that are separated, and so there's two focal points that are very like dispersed and different, though they have one path that connects them that you can lead the targets through. And then in Bangkok, it's a map that's sort of like split vertically. So it's like you have one half of the hotel is very intense, where that's where the Jordan Cross guy is. And then the other half of the hotel is a lot easier. And so you have that sort of like vertical split with like the two halves of the hotel. And so you have that focal point kind of in the top left section of the hotel. And then now I like with Colorado, it's just like you have like a focal point like in kind of almost each corner of the map. And then like the targets move a little bit, but they have like those signs of each focal points. And so there's a sense of like, no matter where you are in kind of close proximity to some target and your attention is constantly being pulled in different directions. And it just creates a very different dynamic.
And it does create a lot of these sort of really fun opportunities for messing with those focal points, but in tandem with one another, or pulling someone out of their focal point. That's actually, I think, in the other maps, one of the hardest things generally is to get someone outside of their own kind of pattern and whatnot. Yeah. And sometimes it's like literally you're not generally going to get someone from the third floor to the first floor or something
Yeah.
You can, but it's going to be difficult, right?
Yeah.
But like I had one, I was playing this last night. I was trying to get the Silent Assassin Challenge, and I, for some reason, I didn't get it. I don't think I messed anything up, but I'd have to try it again,
yeah,
I guess.
The camera stuff is always the stuff that's the hardest to sort of keep track of. Although I don't remember.
I got the camera because you can just destroy it and then you're done. You're good.
Well, sometimes there are different cameras. In levels, sometimes there are multiple different stations that you have to destroy.
I think there's only one in Colorado.
Yeah, right? I haven't done the Silent Assassin movie, so I don't know.
Anyway, I was trying to do Silent Assassin. And so, you know, there are a couple. Silent Assassin, just so you know, is when you have to kill them without being noticed and hide the bodies and nothing will be discovered and you're not discovered. You won't kill any other non-targets, etc.
Yeah.
So a nice like clean run, right?
Yeah.
And for a couple of targets, that's really easy to do because like the two men in this one in particular will retreat to a room or a secluded area where you can easily just fiber wire the shit out of them.
Yeah.
Or in my case, beat them up and then shoot them in the head for fun. Whatever.
Yeah. There was one target that I was taking out the military training lady, and I was trying to do the car one, and just for whatever reason she just wouldn't quite walk to the right place. At this one time I was just got really frustrated, so it's like she got close to the car and then she turned around and walked away. I was like, oh fuck, then I just ran up and like punched her, just like shot her like five times on the ground, and was like, I'm just gonna go do a different challenge because whatever reason, like, you are just not that interested in this quarter on the ground, lady, come on.
Yes, exactly.
It's 25 whole cents.
But yeah, so the guys you can get, but the two women are generally around other people. And in fact, most of the challenges and the opportunities for killing them, you'll be in front of other people and you'll do it as an accident or a poison or something. And in that case, you can't hide the body.
Yeah.
Or you could. You have to be really good at the game.
Yeah.
I'm not that good at the game. But anyway, so like I was trying to find ways to do that. And one of the things is that Penelope Graves, one of the targets, she is one of the people who will walk through that house.
Yeah.
And that house has a basement, which is where I kill Ezra Miller.
Yeah.
Or whatever his name is. Is that it, right?
It's Ezra something. It's definitely Ezra.
Yeah, anyway. Ezra Miller, isn't he the guy playing The Flash?
Yeah.
Okay, that's bad.
Like, one of the main characters in Star Wars Rebels is also called Ezra.
Okay, there's too many Ezras. Anyway.
Except for it's a super rare name, so no.
Yeah, no. But Penelope Graves, she'll walk through the house, and earlier, the way I had gotten into the basement is I crowbarred the door open.
Yeah.
And if you crowbar a door open, the door will stay open.
Yeah, it stays stuck open instead of, if you like lockpick it or find the key, you can close the door open.
But that's turned out, I'm like, because I was knocking my head against the door figuring out, like, how am I going to get Penelope Graves on her own? I managed to do it with Maya. That was okay. I was able to get her. Basically, I did the same thing I did with the car, but then I didn't drop the car on her. I got her further over and then killed her away from prying eyes and dumped the body. So I was fine. But then with Penelope, I was like, this is the last one. And I realized, oh shit, what if I could get her in the basement? And so I went to the basement, I threw a quarter, and she comes down the stairs. And I'm like, okay, threw another quarter, and she comes further down the stairs. It's like I'm an evil, like, Easter rabbit. It's just like, follow the candy. And it's like, here's a quarter. And she's like, huh. And then she comes further down. And that was just a fun moment of like, I would never have thought to get her from her sort of orbit down into this basement, because that's just, she would never naturally go there.
Yeah.
And it was super interesting to like have one of those moments. And it's much more possible on the fly in Colorado. Like, you don't have to pre-plan some of those moments. They will kind of naturally happen if you sort of take the opportunity. And I like that about it.
Yeah, especially because like that way that like if you're focusing on one of the targets and you're trying to do that, like, because this that happened in my first playthrough was like I was trying to get into that like Sean Rose's guy's office or whatever, because I think I was doing the one where you like play with his OCD.
Yeah.
And like while I was doing that, like I saw like that Penelope woman just walked into the house and was staring at the clock that you can like change the face on the clock, which is right underneath the chandelier. And I was like, okay, change of plans. I just shot the chandelier and ran out of the house. Like, I'll do a different challenge for the Sean Rose dude, because like, that just dropped out of, like, that is like heaven just handed this, like, assassination to me on, like, a silver platter. It's like, well, I'm not going to, like, just not drop the chandelier on this lady. Like, come on. Like, those are some of the hardest ones to get these things, to get someone to stand specifically under something, like a fucking car.
Yeah.
So, like, that's really fun, is the way that can kind of spontaneously happen in this map, and the way that, like, it generally would not in the others.
Yes. So, what else should we talk about with this one? We've got... So we had the four targets. I mean, there's fun ways to kill all of them. Or were there a particular challenge or like way to do it that you found particularly enjoyable in this one?
I like, have you done the scarecrow one?
No.
The scarecrow one is fun, where there's a scarecrow costume you can get, and the challenge is to drop the hay bale on Maya. And that's just, like, it's not actually that hard to do, especially if you get the silent sniper rifle to do it, but it's... There's something satisfying about sneaking around as a scarecrow dude and just, like, killing someone with a bale of hay.
I've killed her with the bale of hay. I was not the scarecrow.
Yeah.
Because I killed her with the bale where I used the actual controls, so it was kind of tough. I had to get all the way up.
Yeah, you can just shoot the, like, hinge thing that it's hanging on.
Yeah, I actually didn't realize until this episode that with chandelier kills and stuff, you could just shoot it.
Yeah, you can just shoot them, yeah.
Yeah, I guess I was overthinking it all.
Yeah, because I think it's something where I'm not sure in the Paris map if you can't shoot them, or if it's just that, like, all of them have a winch attached to them in the Paris map, and then, like, they kind of moved away from that in some of the other maps that you don't necessarily... There's not always a physical thing is attached to that you can just mess with.
Because I realized that with Penelope and the chandelier, you have to shoot it, so...
Yeah.
Which I did with a silenced pistol, and it worked, so... Yes.
Okay, yeah. Everyone just runs in and like, what the fuck happened? And I'm just like standing there, my hacker hoodie's like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
No, so I'm just playing with this 3D printer. I don't know. That's like, you fucking creepy motherfuckers making 3D masks of your own faces.
Yeah. The scarecrow stuff, I did the challenge where you poison everyone.
I haven't done that one yet.
That was fun. In fact, I played the game for a couple nights, and then one day at work, I started thinking about it and like planning, because I had recognized all these places you could find poison.
Yeah, like that's the one thing is I think I need to find one more vial of poison to be able to do it.
I can tell you how to do it, because
I want to find it on my own.
Okay, but I'll just, in generalities, I'll say one of my playthroughs I recognized two people you could easily do a lethal injection on. And two people, you can easily poison their drinks.
Right.
And so I kind of recognized that. And then in my head at work, I was putting it together. And I finally figured out my master plan. And I successfully did it that night. And I was so proud, because it takes a little work. But you can definitely do it with poison with all four. And it was a blast. So that one was good. Yeah, I also did a run where I fiber wired all four. Not easy for everyone, but you can do it. The hard one there is Maya is really hard to fiber wire.
Yeah.
But
her route is, like we said, like her route takes her, like she's kind of always in view of somebody.
Yeah. So I figured out how to fiber wire her, And then it's, yeah, the best one. I also, I think there's this spot where Penelope will go into this little greenhouse,
mm-hmm.
and you can do a couple things to her there. One of which is, I love just, you fiber wire her, and then just walk, because you're not going to be able to hide the body.
Yeah.
She's walking and be like, yeah, nothing to see here. Uh-huh. And her guards are standing there, and at one point later, they're going to find a body. And she's like, what the hell happened?
Mm-hmm.
How is she dead? And they probably find, like, bruises and stuff, and know someone snuck in and just fucking strangled her with fiber wire.
Yeah, one of my favorite things was on my first playthrough, one of the first things I did is I snuck into the shed that Ezra goes into to, like, where all of his weird shit is. And there's some, like, challenge-specific items you can get in there. And one of them is the nitroglycerin. And that was before I had found the watch challenge or opportunity at all. So I just found this thing, this vial of fucking nitroglycerin that is just a throwable item.
I didn't know you could throw it.
Yeah, you can just throw it and it just hits and explodes immediately. And so my entire first playthrough, anytime I would mess up, my first reaction would be like, well, I'm going to reload a save, so might as well. I would just like go and I would just get the nitroglycerin and just throw it on the ground and blow up with everyone around me. Because like I really... Because, like, the nitro... Because there's... I don't think there's any other explosive item that just, like, explodes on contact. Like, there's a lot of, like, remote detonated mines and ducks and cell phones and shit that you can get. But, like, this nitroglycerin, you just throw it and just everything fucking explodes instantaneously. It's really great.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. The watch thing is a lot of fun. Because I also... I didn't even follow that as an opportunity. I just organically figured out, oh, I found the battery. He's putting down his watch. I'm going to blow this motherfucker up.
Yeah.
It was great. Love that. Yeah, there's a lot of... I also feel like I did use this... There's that opportunities tab that will kind of walk you through if you want to. And I used that a lot on some of the bigger maps. I didn't use that almost at all on this one.
Yeah, me too.
You didn't really need to. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah. It's just... It's a... You know, like... Unlike you, I don't have, like, much of a problem with the sprawling stuff. Though I see, like, why that would, like... There's, like... Because there are some things that can be a little bit frustrating with how those maps are designed. I just really love... the variety of different takes on this kind of map that they have done.
Oh, yeah.
And it's such a nice change of pace to come in to this Colorado map and just have it feel so different and have all these different sort of kinds of opportunities and flows to the game that are so different from the Bangkok map, which is different from Marrakesh, which is different from Sapienza, which is different from Paris. And, you know, we've got one more left. We've got the Japan map, which I'm very excited to see what that's going to be. But it's like, you know, so far the trend is... Like, it's something where it's like, I'm not even sure at this point, all the maps have been so good and I like them all so much that like, at this point, I don't even really feel like assigning like which one's my favorite. Like I still, there are things about the Sapienza map that are still sort of incredible to me in ways that map can wrap around in ways you wouldn't expect and kind of that map can still surprise me, but they all have something that's so special about them, you know, that they're all so much fun to go back to.
They do. And I'm not inherently opposed to the sprawling stuff, because my favorite map probably is still Marrakesh, which is really big.
Yeah, that's the most sprawling of all of them.
But I also think that one, like, it's very clear where the targets are and what the different spaces are
for. Yeah, they're, like, the targets are a lot more sort of stable in their orbits.
Yeah, so I like that one. But no, I mean... So there's different reasons I kind of like, and I know there's none of these I dislike, like I said. But yeah, Colorado is up there. And I think overall, in general, I do think the game has kind of, maybe not overall improved with each episode, but each episode has something about it that is really special and new and feels like this is doing something I wasn't getting from previous episodes.
Yeah, that it wasn't even something I would expect this game to do, like to change it up like this. Because especially when I first saw that, like when they announced the Colorado map and they said it was going to be four targets, I was initially sort of like, that sounds like a bit, like, because my initial mindset was like, that sounds like that would be a pain in the ass to play through multiple times because it seems like it would take so long to get all those targets when usually it's just two. But, like, the way that they sort of condensed the map and made each target sort of, like, a lot of fun and, like, to take out in different ways, and you can take, like, you can blow through this map really quickly if you know exactly what you're doing.
Poison.
And that's, yeah. Poison or fiber wire or just the fucking
nitroglycerin. Everyone,
nitroglycerin. Everyone, get your sniper rifle up onto that water tower and, you know, just like wait for your opportunity. Like, there's a lot of different things, ways you can approach it, and like it all still feels very Hitman. But like, you know, that four target thing super changes the feel of this map, and it was just nice to like have my fears completely rebuffed. Of like, oh no, like that's not a problem at all. In fact, like it's like in some ways this is the map that I can complete the fastest.
Yes,
compared to the other ones.
Yeah, absolutely. So, good stuff.
Yeah, Hitman still is awesome.
We're very excited to see how they wrap it up with episode 6.
Yeah, curious to see where the story goes. Really
8
curious
targets.
Just like, you have to take out like the entire fucking like government of Japan. They're all targets.
It's set in 1945.
Yeah, It's Agent 47's first hit. That's why he's called Agent 47. It was 1947.
Weren't we occupying Japan in 1947? Why would we do that?
Because we were occupying Japan in 1947. It was right. It was a whole scheme.
All right. So let's go ahead and talk about a very, very different game.
Yes, about as different a game you could be.
Virginia.
Yes.
So to recap, Virginia, it's available wherever games are played, sort of. PC, yeah. Mac, Xbox One,
Atari PS4. 2600.
Not on Atari 2600, unfortunately.
Oh, really? I guess that version got canceled. That's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's a very simple version where it's just you're a pixel on the screen moving around. And,
yeah. But, like, I think the Atari version of the score, I think, is very effective.
Yeah, indeed. So, Virginia, like I said, it's made by a small team. It is very cinematic in some ways, although very video gamey in others, and I think that's important to talk about.
Yeah.
It has, as we said, sort of cinematic cuts and jump cuts, but it is still a first-person perspective. It is sort of in this growing genre of games people are sort of lovingly calling walking sims in some terms. So you have that. It is inspired by the works of David Lynch and some of the kind of sci-fi inspired stuff of the 90s. So Twin Peaks, maybe some people can compare it to X-Files. Again, I don't think that's a super...
They're like I don't think stylistically the game isn't very X-Files, but like... The assistant director's office is just A.D. Skinner's office. Okay. Like, the FBI partner that, like, is being investigated on and is in, like, a dank fucking office in the basement of the FBI, like, that is just X-Files.
Okay, then that's fair.
And one of the character models looks exactly like Scully.
Okay, so there's that. Oh, yeah, she does. You don't see her much, okay.
Yeah, but you see her one time when you don't have a context for who she is, and I was like, is that just supposed to be Scully?
Yeah, so anyway... that's kind of where its DNA comes from. But it ultimately becomes, I think, its own thing. Very much so. So spoilers from here on out. Sean, what'd you think?
I think it's really cool. Like, that's my main... Like, it has a confidence in its presentation that is really sort of infectious. That it's just like... I mean, from like minute one, you pointed this out last week that, you know, the first prompt they give you is press X to take a trip, which brings you into the main menu instead of press X to start, which that kind of sets the tone. Like, it has, like, the main menu says, like, play feature instead of just, like,
it's like a game. DVD menu.
Yeah, and then, like, the opening credits, it, like, has, like, these, like, really stark, bright red, solid screens and stuff that the color red is very, like, sort of visually important through the game. And there's just, like, and then the score, which is from the Prague Philharmonic Orchestra, is so powerful and interesting and strong and dynamic. And it feels like, I mean, it feels kind of like when, you know, Sony had the orchestra at their E3 presentation and the orchestra was just playing the music for the trailers and stuff live. It kind of felt like that, where it's like, it just feels like this orchestra is playing my, like, scoring my game live, because the way that they do the jump cuts and stuff is that it tends to edit on the music. Yes. And so it's like all that stuff, just the way that they present it, it's so bold and it's so different for video games that, again, like, there's literally only one other game I know of that was just called 30 Flights of Loving that does the jump cut thing. That's the only one.
Like, and the game actually cites it at the end in the credits. They say special thanks to the makers of 30 Flights of Loving for the inspiration for this game.
Yeah, so it's like, it's such a weird, strange, bizarre thing, but like, it so sort of like wraps you up in how it's telling its story, whether or not the story like ends up being super impactful at the end or not. Like, the way they tell the story feels like it's super important in this game.
And I would say the story is super impactful. Whether it all hangs together might be a question. Yeah. But I mean, whether it left an impact on me, yeah, that's undeniable. Like,
yeah,
it,
they managed to do multiple like montages in this game that are kind of breathtaking, you know?
Absolutely breathtaking. I mean, let's break it down a little bit. What's the basic narrative in this game? It's tough to describe, but as I said like last week, as with any David Lynch movie, whatever your starting synopsis is not what the actual story is. So your starting synopsis for Virginia is that you are sort of a rookie at the FBI. You are assigned to work with and investigate an older agent, who, not like old, but like a more senior agent, who is maybe up to something you don't know. And then
he has this dank office in the basement that is... Yes. All she is missing is the I Want to Believe poster, and it would just be the office from the X-Files.
I had not been thinking of that. Yeah. I was thinking more in narrative ways, but you're right. Stylistically, that's very X-Files.
Yeah, like, she straight up just has like the projector thing on her desk and everything. It's super X-Files.
It's awesome. So anyway, but you are investigating the disappearance of a local boy. Is it girl?
Boy Lucas.
Boy Lucas.
Yeah.
From this town called...
What's the Kingdom.
Town? Kingdom. So Kingdom, Virginia. You go there and you're investigating a little bit. But again, that's only the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, because it's not L.A. Noire or something. It's not an investigation game.
No, and now that we can talk in terms of spoilers, really, this is a game about dreams. This is a game about the dreamscapes. This is a game about identity and a personal moment of crisis. And yeah, when you talk about the montages, that's where the game really gets going. Because you have a lot of slow setup at the beginning. It's beautiful. It's atmospheric. This game manages to do a ton with story and character without an iota of dialogue.
Yeah.
And that's amazing and deserves credit. But really is when it, I think, kicks into high gear in that last hour where at some point reality just stops being a factor in the game. And yeah. That's what I need to go back and play for because there's a solid like 45 minutes of this game that is just a dream or something. Yeah. And you never go back to whatever that layer of reality is. It's like if Inception ended with Leonardo DiCaprio in the, like, city with all the sand and stuff, and we never saw him get back to his kids or something.
Yeah.
You're just like, okay, we never actually left the dream, and we weren't aware it was a dream, and it's very...
Yeah, that's a very good comparison point, is it is like, it feels like, and it, like, I don't want it to have this moment, but it feels like it is very deliberately does not have the, like, top falling over moment. Like, it's not trying to do that. It's not trying to, like... make you think as like, oh, yeah, we're back in reality, or are we? It's just like, what is reality, dog? Like, that's the kind of approach it takes to it.
Well, it's the kind of approach where the story is not dependent on chronology. The story is not dependent on real-life events or anything.
Yeah.
The story is one of an emotional arc, and that emotional arc wraps up, and then the game decides, we're done. There's other things we could wrap up, but we're not going to.
Yeah.
And I commend it for that. There's things to talk about there, but... Yeah, I mean, I played this game last night. I played it a week ago. I have liked it more the more I've thought about it.
Yeah, I think like it is something that is like it was a rough game to play right before you go to sleep because it's just yes. One of those where you're just lying in bed and you're like, what the fuck was with that fucking buffalo? What was that?
Yes, I mean, there's so many weird things to pick apart. I mean, the montage, one of the montages I assume you were talking about is. There's this point in the game, and I think this must be around the point where reality just stops being a factor, where you and your partner are in jail.
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear really why. There's a lot of things we could talk about there. But once you're in jail, you kind of go to this interior fantasy place, if you're not already in an interior fantasy place, and you sort of imagine getting out of jail by ratting on your partner, and then you rat on another person, and it starts slow, and then this montage builds and builds of you basically... compromising your morals again and again and again, just by inches and inches and inches until you keep getting these promotions and you keep getting these promotions and eventually you are back to the starting place of the game, but instead of you walking across the stage being a trainee, you are the head of the FBI giving the badge to a trainee.
Yeah, it's sort of a, you either die a molder or you see yourself live long enough to see yourself become a cigarette-smoking man.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, but that montage, is that the height of the game, would you say?
Yeah, because that is where the game takes the turning point for sure. Of like you, there's a sort of like, did this make that jump earlier than what I'm seeing? And like, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But like, that is definitely the moment where it's like, from that point, you're like, is this whole, like, did that montage actually happen? And this whole game is a flashback for her thinking back to the series of events and how she made a mistake and wish she had gone another way. Or, like, was that her flashing forward thinking, like, oh, this is how my life could go. But instead, I'm going to eat this fucking sticker of a cardinal and then the brick's going to fall off the wall. And I'm going to go to a cult where someone is sacrificing a buffalo.
That was pretty cool, too.
Yeah. I think it was all just a cult that is worships a buffalo, and this is just this girl having a crazy trip. That's like, she's never been an FBI agent or anything. It's just set in this, like, deliberate, like, beautiful fantasy world that is all focused around, like, buffalo, and you just don't have that. Like, there's this whole Virginia Bible, like, lore Bible they've made that tells you all about it.
Okay.
But that's the only point in the game where it's the reality is the cult.
When I was playing the game... I definitely came at it from the perspective of we're projecting into the future.
Right.
And then we're kind of back to the present, but you really never go back to the present. And so
there are weird moments where, like, because they very deliberately have her, like, hand model when she's older, has all these wrinkles on it. And then there are moments where it goes back to, like, the present timeline, whether or not it's reality or not. It's, like, set in that present area of time where she still has the wrinkles on her hands. And it's like, fucking who knows?
Yeah. I mean, but what I was going to say is that since then, definitely that alternate interpretation where this isn't a flash forward, this is a flashback, and we just don't get to the future until the end.
Yeah.
That one also makes sense, and maybe in some ways makes more sense because it also gives you more perspective for the finale of the game.
Yeah.
But I think part of the beauty of it is I do think it can work either way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There is definitely a point where whatever our set view of quote-unquote reality does fade away. And I like, and it is very Lynchian in this way, you don't know where that moment happens.
Uh-huh.
There's something very mundane about how it presents dreams and about how it presents non-reality. And, you know, I think, I quoted Inception earlier, and I love it. I think it's a phenomenal movie.
Yeah.
That's not actually at all really a good analogy for this sort of thing, because Christopher Nolan is a guy who really does think in, I think, ordered terms.
Yeah,
he likes
yeah.
to put things in boxes, and it's the way his mind moves.
Yeah, like his conception of dreams is like the structured, ordered layer yes. of things. Yeah.
Which is a real philosophy of dreams. That's yeah. not just him. But I do find generally the ones that hit me harder on that level of like recognition and stuff is the Lynchian view of dreams, where David Lynch has this kind of thing where he doesn't really care if you know whether you're watching reality or not.
Yeah.
There are, I think Twin Peaks is supposed to be real, but there are whole interpretations of Twin Peaks where this is happening in someone's mind, or it is dream-esque, or I think one of the implicit messages of all of Lynch's work is that dreams do intersect with reality, and to pretend that they are completely separate is foolish.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things, is that Twin Peaks is dream-esque because life is dream-esque, and there is the surreal in life. And so that's one of those ideas that I think Virginia also uses as kind of a starting point, which is it's not going to explicitly signal to you when they transition into some kind of dream. And it's funny because early on they set you up to think they're going to do
that. Yeah, they have the out-of-body experience thing near the beginning of the game that then I think they only do that one more time, like very yeah. like specifically. But that does set you up to sort of like question like your perspective, like kind of like question the sort of like the subjectivity of what you're viewing, that then like they complicate that a lot in one of the late montages where it's like you are, your perspective is inhabiting other people, and then like it cuts in, like you're looking at it from the outside and you realize like, oh, that wasn't my character, though it was like the model, like when you looked down it was your character, but now I see it was the weird priest dude.
Yes.
You know, like it does that, and it's sort of, it's playing with what your viewpoint is.
Yeah, and I'll have to say, while the sort of climbing the ladder montage is, I think, one of the most breathtaking moments, the one that probably emotionally hit me hardest is the one you're talking about, where we switch perspectives.
Yeah.
Because that, just, I don't even know how to verbalize it. On a subconscious level, that encompasses the themes of this game so perfectly and beautifully. It's an amazing moment.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the gameplay aspect of it has to enter in. This is very cinematic in language, but it could not be a movie.
It has
to be a video game. You're talking about the idea of subjectivity. This is as much an essay on the notion of subjectivity and identity as it is anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And having it be a first-person experience where your hands are on the controller, moving things, is so important because you develop... It asks you to question what that first-person view even is. And I think it's a very powerful thing that gets more powerful as the game goes along.
Yeah, it's just playing on something that, like, I'm super interested in video games. Because there's an attitude, it's, like, appropriate to talk about it specifically around Virginia as well. Because, you know, we talked about the walking simulator stuff earlier. And there's this attitude from certain sections of the gaming audience that has been there since, like, Myst and stuff like that. Or even the Shinmu has been complained about this, of like games that like they're not really games because like, oh, like Metal Gear Solid has so many cutscenes, or like Shinmu's like it's a forklift simulator, it's not a real video game because there's no real failed state. Although that technically is a failed state, but it's like it's kind of impossible to hit. But like, or like Gone Home is the most recent one that had the huge controversy. It's like, oh, it's not a real game. You're just walking around a house and looking at letters. Like, that's not an actual video game. Like, this could just be a movie or blah, 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 blah. And it's like, that perspective frustrates me so much because when that's your argument, like, you're selling what video games are so short. Because it's like, the sheer act of having just the most minimal amount of control over something fundamentally changes your experience with that thing. So it's like, you know, Virginia is an incredibly directed experience. Like, it is a game, more than any other game I think I've ever played, it is a game that you can definitively say that it is about 2 hours long.
Yes.
Because no matter what you fucking do, you are going to finish that game in about 2 hours. Like, there are places where, like, I guess if you decided just to, like, very stubbornly never press X, you will not go forward. But, like, that is the only way that the game will roadblock you as if like you just sitting there staring at the X prompt and going, no, never, I'm never going to press X.
It honestly makes me think of moments in like the Stanley Parable,
yeah,
where you can go just stand in the cupboard.
Yeah, and like get a different ending. Yeah.
That's kind of what it's joking about. It's like, you can try to have control all you want. And that's one of the messages of Stanley Parable that I think makes it so smart is that video games are always directed.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes that's more obvious than in other cases, but there is always some kind of direction to it. And so to pretend that something like Virginia is disqualified from being a video game for that purpose is ludicrous.
Yeah, because it's just that your ability to sort of directly inhabit this character changes your relationship to that character, to that point of view, and to all the characters around you, because it inherently makes it more personal. Whether or not you're like realizing that or not, I think it's an unconscious kind of effect. But it's the sort of thing that, like, when you're playing Persona 4 or something, like your relationship towards the investigation team in Persona 4 or like your squad in Mass Effect is developed in such a different way than if that had been a TV show. Or like if, like, literally you can use Persona 4 as an example, because there is an animated version of the show or of the game that's a TV show, and it's like watching that TV show and your relationship towards Chie there is 100% different than like playing the game and going through Chie's social link and having her in your party in the dungeons. Like, your relationship through those characters fundamentally change through your interacting with them in the game, whether or not those interactions are like the deepest interactions in the world, or in like Virginia, it's just you choosing to look at your partner while you're sitting on the side of the car or not. Like, that changes what the experience is to you, and crafts the experience subtly to you how you're playing it.
And having that character's eyes.
Yeah.
I think that's something you also can't discount, because, you know, just using the idea of cuts as an example, there are some very jarring cuts in this game.
Yeah.
Some of them, if you were looking at this in a more third-person perspective, would not be as jarring. But it's because we're used to, you know, films do not take place in first person.
Yeah.
And
Whether the Hardcore Henry was that movie
called? That movie, yeah.
There is at least one movie that does literally take place in first person.
There's Hardcore Henry, yeah. And then there's, like, you know, found footage movies that some people want to rename first person. And actually, there is a term in experimental film called first person cinema.
Yeah.
But that's more of an avant-garde sort of thing, where it's not so much about following a specific character's eyes as inhabiting an eye that is... And you see this in movies like by Terrence Malick and whatnot, where the perspective of the camera is something you're supposed to question, but it's almost more, is it a deity? Is it a spirit?
Right.
You know, what is the eyes of this machine we see things through? That's a question film can ask. Cinema is never successfully going to be a thing where you're just watching from behind someone's eyes,
yeah,
a la Hardcore Henry.
Yeah, yeah.
That's only ever really going to be a gimmick. The thing that Virginia is doing, where you are literally in the subjective viewpoint of the character, that can only be done in video games.
Yeah.
Well, and I guess in novels if you're doing the eye voice thing, but even that's very different because...
Yeah, like that's a... I have had the unreliable narrator conversation a lot in English classes over the course of my life, but it's a very different thing.
Very different thing. So... Yes, the simple fact that Virginia can do that and turn that into part of its aesthetics is very important.
Yeah, and just, like, there's subtle things that they do while it's, like, it's, like I said, it's not L.A. Noir, or it's not even Gone Home. Like, you're not going around and, like, taking your time being able to investigate every little thing. Like, sometimes, you know, you'll be trying to investigate something or, like, read a case file or something. It'll make a cut before you finish and stuff like that. But, like, so it's not, like, this in-depth investigation kind of game, but... The fact that you have this first-person point of view, and there are sections of the game where you can go around and look at the environment as much as you want before you go walk to like the seat and press X or whatever, like, triggers the next sequence. Like, there is an element of you being able to walk around and sort of be like, okay, so that's this, and like, what the fuck is this, like, weird emblem thing that she has in all these scenes, and what is this red envelope, and like, why is there a, like, why is this door padlocked on the outside? This is nobody locks a door like that. That's fucking crazy. And where is this lady's husband? And like, there's like stuff like that, of these questions you can ask. That, like, in a movie, obviously, like, you can use visual language to sort of prompt the audience to have the same questions. But in a game like this, it is up to you to, like the biggest section of that is, like, I just gave some examples of it, is when you wake up in your partner's apartment and you have opportunities to sort of walk around a little bit, and there's some, like, weird side rooms and stuff that you can choose to go into those rooms or not. And, like... If you choose to go into those rooms, you can either just sort of, like, look at it and go, like, oh, there's nothing here. Or you can go and be, like, huh, like, why is there a bed in this room? Like, where is the main bedroom? Is that where the lock is? Like, you can ask questions as much as you want and sort of investigate those questions as much as the game will allow you. And that's something that a movie could not provide, a book could not provide. You need the free agency that a game provides you to sort of, like, interact with it in that way. And that creates a very different kind of experience with this sort of dreamlike, bizarre narrative that this game delivers.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the last hour of the game or so, last 40 minutes, is very fast-paced, I guess you could say. It is breathless. It is. I think this game has a very symphonic structure in that it moves you along. And it has peaks and it has valleys. But when it gets going, it is a freight train. And it is powerful stuff that you are seeing and going through. The slow stuff that you're describing is mostly kind of in the first half, when you're thinking it might be a little more conventional than it is, you know? Although there's always clues that it's not.
Yeah, it definitely sets you up with, like, that out-of-body experience and some of those more jarring cuts at the beginning or the opening credits. Like, it is definitely signaling to the player, whether, like, you've heard about what this game is or not, like, hey, this game is different. Like,
so let's talk about some of that story.
Okay.
Because, again, you've got the basic mission at the beginning. You've got to find this kid.
Fucking Lucas.
And you move around and you're kind of, you investigate his parents, you look around the town, you investigate this planetarium he went to. Did you ever feel like, I don't think the game wanted this, so I'm not saying this is a fail, I'm just curious. Did you ever feel like there was any actual moment where you had a sense of where this case was going or what it was?
Not really, because, like, you know, it's something where you can piece some stuff together of, like, it's a missing persons report and, like, there's no body because they never show a body or anything. And I think that's part of, like, the point of the ending is, like, what probably happened is the kid just skipped town. Like, that's probably literally all it was. But like, you know, there's stuff that they do with visual language. Like, okay, the dad is a priest and the kid, like, has a weird secret, like, photograph room that, like, there's, like, cans of beer in his cave and stuff like that. If you go into the dad's room at their house, you can see that their beds are separated with his wife. So it's like, they do not have the most, like, loving marriage. Like, there are things you can pick up about what's going on, and then you have the weird Scully lookalike character that, like, there's some sort of, like, affair going on with her and the guy's dad, and maybe he had, like Lucas also liked her, who knows? But yeah, it's definitely, it is not a murder mystery or anything like that. It's in fact, it's kind of playing off of that by having, like, the most classic red herring of all, which is, like, the, you know, the strict dad, like, the strict family member that probably killed him, and there was some sort of affair, but, like, that wasn't what it actually was. It was something else the whole time. Like, that's in every murder mystery, you have that, you know?
Right, and they play with that a little bit, because there's a moment where you bring the dad and the mom in for questioning and stuff. Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, I think you're right. The point is not that it gets solved, and I think if you read in between the lines, it's pretty explicit this is never solved. This never comes together, you know, like, because while we don't return to a layer of reality, that final image of the kid walking on the road, whether that's an intimation, whether that's a flashback, whether that's something she saw and didn't talk about, whatever it is, whether it's a fantasy projection of, like, this is the good version of what happened.
Yeah.
I think the point is there were no answers to this.
Yeah. And it probably was not something extraordinary, you know. It like you know, it probably was not something like that UFO thing that happens at the end, because then they undercut it with, like, then cutting to the kid just, like, scrambling up the hill and running into the forest. It's like, that's probably what just happened. Like, it probably wasn't the X-Files, it probably wasn't Twin Peaks. There's nothing insane going on in this town. For all we know, the kid wasn't even murdered because there's no body.
Exactly. So there's nothing insane going on there, but there is a lot of insanity in this game. Just to recap a few things, you have the conspiracy with your partner and her mother.
Yeah.
Who did something, and we don't really know what, and we can talk about that.
She was the Mulder of the X-Files, or of the FBI, is what it feels like she has.
Basically.
Weird shit was going on, and they didn't like her. Also, she was a black woman working in the FBI in the 60s, and so there's something going on there.
Right, so there's that. You know, you have all the weird things in your visions. And then, of course, there's the buffalo, which recurs until you get to the end. And there's a full cult around the buffalo.
You have, like, the cardinal is a recurring image, the bird. Yeah, like the bird. Your weird, what you eventually find out is a key that, like, I guess your character's dad gave you. Whoever, like, the character was on the hospital bed at the end.
Yeah.
Like, that pops up. The weird red letter that has, like, the stamp thing in it, whatever that was.
That's really LSD, basically.
Or is it LSD? Like, who, like, that, the red envelope thing is the thing that I think I'm most, like, I have no idea what that was.
Yeah, it's very strange. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of symbol. It's you have to, It's a confusing game, and it's one that I, the more we talk about it, the more I want to go play it again.
Yeah.
Because you realize that I think you're set up to view things on a certain level of reality, and it turns out like 90% of the images you see are symbolic. They are not literal.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the more we talk about it, the more I think the cult with the buffalo speaks to, you know, it is not literally that there was a cult with a buffalo is freaking things out. Although I do think there's ways you can look at this game and not get that, because it is so into the mystical and strange.
Like, maybe that was like the cult, the buffalo cult killed the kid the whole time.
Whatever,
I guess you could maybe interpret it that way if you want.
But no, it's a symbol of the buffalo being sort of the innocence of this town, or some kind of innocence. Yeah. And the people in the masks and stuff are the FBI people, and this like heavy amount. Yeah, and this dad, and this heavy amount of guilt of all these kind of systems that are systematically killing goodness and innocence and those kinds of things. And I think as an image, it works very powerful on that level.
Yeah.
I am talking myself into liking this game more, because I think part of it, and I kind of wish you had played it last week, because I played the game and I was so like, oh, what was that? And then I had no one to talk to about it.
Right, yeah.
And it was really tough. Like, I'm like, all I have is my own head. And it's really tough for this kind of game. Being able to actually have a back and forth on it illuminates a lot about this game, because I do think the more you talk about it, whether it is a forward projection, whether it is a backwards projection, whatever it is about this institutionalization of this person's life and their identity and who they are choosing to be and sort of the sacrifices that can be made. And the game overall is this character, again, forward, backwards, whatever, indicting that idea of sacrificing herself to be climbing the ladder.
Yeah. And then there's some other stuff that I want to ask you about. Like, did you get a sense, like, I don't know, like, because I feel pretty strongly about this interpretation, but I feel like I'm projecting onto it. Like, did you get a sense that your character, like, is kind of in love with her partner that she has to investigate? Like, there's a...
No, I did not.
Because there's something about, like, it's specifically what sealed it for me is, like, the scene where the partner takes off the wedding ring and then gives it to you and then you put it on. Like, I feel like that is... And then there's just something about, like, the attitude of, like, when she, like, opens up the locket and is kind of freaked out about seeing, like, what's in the locket and everything like that near the beginning of the game. Like, there's something about, like, her relationship towards her partner that feels like there's something going on there that is more than just, like, I'm investigating you and you're another FBI agent, you know?
I mean, I definitely felt there's a connection in so much as this is someone she looks up to.
Right.
And someone she is very concerned with. And almost from the first beat, she does not have malice towards this person. She is trying to get him back on her side. But I saw it more as a friendship thing. And like, if the regret that exists there is more because she had this potential friendship and she threw it away. I don't like discount your theory. Yeah. I didn't read it that way. The way you talk about it, I can see that. But I think it's probably left ambiguous for good reason, you know?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's not, like, any big... Because, again, the game has no dialogue, so there's, like, so much of it is you trying to, like, interpret, like, what does that mean when she puts on the wedding ring? Is she just, like, trying not to get hit on, or does that have more significance than that?
Okay, you just played it, so I have a question for you.
Yeah, okay.
There's that secret, the most David Lynch sequence in the whole thing, which is where you go to the bar, and you're with the woman, and then there's the...
And they're just singing, like, what is, like, the Twin Peaks theme with, like, two notes, like, off...
Yeah, basically. Yeah. It's also very much like the Club Silencio scene in Mulholland Drive.
Right, yeah.
Which does come... I mean, if you're using Lynch as... It depends on how much you want to use Lynch as a kind of reference for this game. But like Mulholland Drive, the Club Silencio scene, which this very much quotes, and scenes in Twin Peaks, comes after a romantic consummation between two women.
Right, yeah.
I do think that's the one scene where I maybe got romantic vibes. But the partner kind of leaves that scene at a certain point, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think there's a sense of, like, the partner is not reciprocating anything. Yeah, yeah. Like, I think it's, like, a one-sided... Because also the partner is married to somebody, because you never... Like, that's my biggest question is, like, where the fuck in that house is that lady's husband or wife or two... Well, no, because the game is set in the 90s, so I guess she wouldn't be married if she's just lesbian. So it's, like... Like, that was one of my biggest questions. Like, what the fuck? Where's... You're supposed to be married, lady. What's going on?
Yeah, I didn't even really catch that. Because there's the ring. I didn't know if that was supposed to be a wedding ring, I guess.
I assume it was supposed to be a wedding ring.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So, yeah, there's all that. What other questions did you have?
Did you, like, I think one of the other scenes that, like, I really couldn't really make anything of, and I don't know if, like, I just couldn't remember if this character had been somewhere else, is the sequence in one of the late montages where, with, like, them building the wooden ship... And you're like her, and then you like shift perspective, and you see it's a guy at a desk. Like, that one was like one of the only moments in the montage where like, I just actually don't get what this one is doing here at all.
Yeah, I don't know.
That one is just like I feel like maybe because there's another sequence early on where she sort of has a weird sort of like dream nightmare sequence where she's like in the passenger seat of a car with like one of like the white FBI dudes driving the car. And they almost hit someone and it like cuts really fast. That like I felt like maybe that was the guy building ship. I don't know.
That's one where I guess there is something in the game that we might have just missed that sets that up or pays it off. And you would just have to go look into it. But I definitely do think later in the game there's some stuff in the montages that might be the game, I don't want to say going up its own ass, but maybe being a little too indulgent in things that you really can't expect someone to see on one viewing.
Yeah.
Because this is a game you make over years and years, they're going to get all of that. But I think there are some references here and there where I think it's maybe too much piece it together yourself.
Yeah, because like most of the time, at the very least, like even if it's not something where you're like, oh, I understand exactly what, like this is fitting precisely into this interpretation of the game I'm having.
Right.
Like most of the scenes don't have that because it is so dreamlike, but most of them at least have a reference point of like, oh, I'm sitting here eating dinner with like the lady who's the receptionist for the DA, or like the ADA, and like we're right in front of where his office is. Like, I at least understand like where we are in the geography of the world and like who the people are. And like that shipbuilding scene was the one most where I was like, what? Because it's not like, at least the cult scene is like so out of nowhere that you're like, okay, this is just complete fantasy. Like, maybe this whole ship was just, or maybe this whole game was just about you building a ship the whole time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think there's definitely some moments in that montage where it's such a tricky thing to do with that kind of like dream-like Lynchian reality with like the recurring visual symbolism and everything that sometimes maybe people, like maybe the creators just want to throw in a red herring that like they don't even have any idea what they wanted to sort of convey with it. It's just like, hey, this is something I thought I could put into this montage.
And I guess it's only a complaint because there's enough else in the game that does feel focused to me and
yeah.
that I can identify that if you wanted to do that, I'd probably put more red herrings in. Like, you
sure,
know,
yeah.
honestly, if I wanted to go in that direction and just, and then you're kind of going, this is an avant-garde game. I'm not going to say it's not, but you're kind of going more full avant-garde in a cinematic language sense, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But there's some stuff I like. Like, I like that you have the whole scene where the guy who I assume is your character's dad who's on the hospital bed like gives you that key after you show him that you made it to the FBI, which obviously like that draws a connection between you and your partner who had like that relationship with her mother that was part of the FBI.
Yeah.
And then he gives you the key and then you go to the closet like open like get the box and you never see what's in the box because you just like set it on fire. I like that you just never see what's in the box.
No, that's
like that's part of like what is feels like powerful about the game to me is that like a lot of that ending montage feels like it is saying like it is not like there's nothing that important in the box. It's like there's nothing that important in this case. Like it's not about those individual moments. Like it is about like in the montage going forward of like it's about every single time she decides to rat on a partner and about every single time she decides to give a case to a junior detective to rat on a partner. It's not about like one singular moment that is defining everything about this woman's life.
No, and I think that's probably the overriding message of the thing.
Yeah.
And that you have... Yeah, so go. I was going to say something else. I don't even know where I'm going with it.
Yeah.
There's so many things you could say about this.
Yeah, I think just like the game is very smart in terms of its being able to sort of undercut itself in ways that feel very impactful. That comes across just in the presentation of like that is what literally like jump cutting is most of the time. But then it also sort of a thematic idea of like they will show you something like the UFO scene that's sort of like the most visually spectacular next to the cult. And then like, oh, like, this is what happens. He got abducted by this UFO because you see earlier also, there's all the stuff with the observatory that's like also part of like a weird military base or something is over there. And you, when you look through the guy's, Lucas's journal, he has a drawing that he did of like a UFO in the town. And so it's like, oh, that's what it was the whole time. But it's like, no, he just jumped over this fence and ran because he got in a fight with his dad and he couldn't stand being in this town with this like priest dad anymore. That's probably all it was. He just took his guitar and booked it.
I mean, I do like this idea of the text in the game not being important is the text of the game.
Yeah.
Because, like, there are a lot of moments where you are maybe handed a report, or there's a piece of evidence you could go investigate, or there's something you feel like you're about to understand, and the game yanks the rug out from under you by explicitly cutting, and it is constantly undercutting your ability to have any overriding sense of the minutiae of events, even though I think by the end you have a pretty good sense of the overall scope of events and of what the game wants you to get thematically. And I think that's actually a very smart thing, that through that lens, the game starts making a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Because as you say, the specific details of this case, the specific ideas of what's going on, are so not what's important, and it's saying that's not even what's important to the lives these characters lead. And again, going back to that idea of that montage where we're switching from perspective to perspective to perspective and seeing all these different pieces of minutiae, and maybe that's all the ship in the bottle is supposed to be, is it's just a ship in a bottle, and it's a minutiae a person is consumed with, and that is what makes it important, is that this one person is consumed with it in that moment, and it gives them identity. I think broadening that is so much about what the game is about, is getting lost in the own minutiae. And this is what that character at this point in her life does. If she does indeed rat out her partner, she gets lost in this one case and sells her soul in the process.
Yeah.
It reminds me very much that moment of one of my favorite scenes in any movie ever. It's Wes Anderson's The Darjeeling Limited.
Right.
There's this scene near the end where the three brothers, they're on this journey in India. They go to meet their mother, who's at a Christian monastery there. And they have this like little prayer session almost. And the camera switches from around the circle to each person. And then it keeps switching, but now we're switching to different views of other characters we've seen, like, in brief passing in the movie. So, like, Bill Murray had this one cameo. Natalie Portman is in the short film attached to that, and we see her, and then some other random people from the movie. And it's like they're each in a train car, although none of them are actually, but they've, like, taken the set and put it in the car of a train and bisected it. So it's like this train of life with all these people consumed in their own little worldviews. And I feel like Virginia is very much kind of doing the same kind of idea there at the end.
Yeah.
And it's why I think that sequence is so powerful, is this idea of the broadening of perspective, and that if this is a meditation, which I think is maybe the best way to think of this game, it's the character sort of having this realization about herself that she's never going to have if she only stays within her own perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just such a... Like I said at the top of this discussion, like, I want to see more games like this, because I want to have more conversations like this, you know, like, I want to have, because it's just this unexplored territory, I feel like, because I think it's partially a lot of the gaming audience's fault for rejecting, or like, for having this like really vocal attitude against stuff like Myst back in the 90s or Gone Home Now as being not real games because they have this story focus and stuff like that. But it was something like when I was like near the, like in the early parts of the game, and I was sort of like getting into the flow of how they're cutting and stuff. Like, I just had this like fantasy of like, man, what if, and a part of this is like the cutting stuff, like that is technically very difficult. So it's like, there's an element of that as well. That's like, I mean, obviously it's like you can do it. And that's one of the reasons why not just it's made by a small studio, but also the cutting stuff, it forces them to have the very sort of simplistic art style that I think they pull off very well. But, like, you know, you can't load in, like, this beautiful Uncharted 4 sequence, just, like, cut to it magically. Like, you couldn't just cut from the all the guys in the auction in, like, level 4 of Uncharted 4 to Drake and everyone, like, on the island, because you just can't load in the assets like that. Like, that's technically impossible. So, like, there's that hurdle. But, like, what if this kind of game had become popular, like, this genre had become popular, like, in the 360 era, and, like, it was just something that, like, a couple of them came out every single year. It was just like they were like for $5 to $10, and you could get another like 2 to 3 hour video game movie that's like, you know, it's that sort of very focused, directed narrative experience that is told by blending like video game language and cinematic language. Like, I think there's so much territory to be explored there, and so interesting to me to just see that evolution of the cutscene stuff. Like, you know, thinking back to me playing Shinmu last week, which is, along with Metal Gear Solid, one of the first games to sort of, like, really push cinematic storytelling in video games and having cutscenes and having quick time events, which is where literally that term comes from, Shinmu. Like, trying to blend what, like, movies can do and what games can do in terms of telling stories. And I like to see Virginia just say, like, let's just fucking, instead of it being like a game where sometimes you kind of watch a movie and maybe you have a quick time event, like, let's just take what movies can do with stories and what games can do with stories and just mush it together as much as we possibly can and make it so you can't even see the line between what those two mediums are. They're just like, they're empowering each other.
No, I think Gone Home was a huge watershed in indie games. And yeah, I think definitely. If you look at the influence it's had over the last 3 years, it's incalculable. I mean, up to the point where Uncharted 4 was every bit as influenced by Gone Home as Absolutely. It was The Last of Us.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And so we've been using that as an example for years now of like, Gone Home is clearly influencing this, this, and this. I think in 3 years we're going to be saying that about Virginia.
Yeah, I like, really hope so. Like, I really want more stuff like this.
I mean, I'm just curious because like, I don't know what I expected to be the first AAA game to clearly take from Gone Home, but it wound up being Uncharted 4.
Yeah.
What will be the first AAA game to clearly take from Virginia? Man. You know what I mean? Because it's going to happen.
Yeah. Like, that would fuck, dude. Like, a full AAA studio's weight behind this sort of, like, cinematic cutting presentation thing. That would be fucking nuts.
It would be absolutely nuts. Yeah. I'm very curious. So, yeah, if you got $10 and you got 2 hours and you're interested in this kind of thing, play Virginia, support Virginia. This is the beginning of something.
Yeah. This game is super cool. You know, like, it's just one of those, another sort of, like, piece to add onto the pile of like, this is a really great year in video games. Like, it's not just like you have Uncharted 4 and Doom, you have Inside and Virginia, which like, I think there's also an interesting conversation in comparing those two games in sort of like, they're very different games, but I think some of the ways they try to tell their stories feel similar to me. It's like, nuts, you know, like it's
totally nuts. I you know, I keep a running tally of everything I play and watch in a given year so I can make lists at the end. I was looking at my game list the other day. I'm up to like 14 or 15 games. Uh-huh. I absolutely want on my top 10.
Yeah, it's getting rough. You know,
it's going to be a bloodbath making this fucking list.
December's going to be
crazy.
A game changer probably in a lot of ways.
Yeah. All right. So that's it for this week. Next week we're going to be talking Godzilla.
Yeah. There's one more thing I want to talk about before we wrap this up. But yeah, like I'm really excited about talking Godzilla next week. But I just remembered there's another game I've been playing a little bit. Like, I would talk about Shinmu last week. I played through all of Shinmu in Japanese, and I had such a fun time with that. I thought I would try something else out as well. So I've been playing another small game in Japanese just to sort of test the waters and see what it's like. And it's, I don't know what the English title is, but in Japanese it's called Persona 5. And I've just been, sort of tinkering with it. I'm about 8 hours in.
Wait, what?
It's this small, weird indie game. It's sort of this JRPG. It's set in high school. I downloaded it digitally off of the Japanese PSN store. It's very easy to do. All you have to do is go to a store like Play Asia Online
you
or something.
You son of a bitch.
Yeah, and I've sort of dipping my toes in the water. It's okay. Yeah. So I've just been doing that on the side.
I'm cutting this off.